This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Spoiler number one is Dr. Lee Franz. It stinks.
What is going on?
Episode 36, Submission 012, Pink Lady and Jeff. Pink Lady and Jeff aired on NBC from March 1st to April 4th, 1980, for a total of 6 episodes, one of which went unaired.
Welcome to
The 1970s had a ton of variety shows, whether you're talking about Future Entry, the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, or Donnie and Marie, or Sonny and Cher, or even you could say The Muppet Show or Saturday Night Live. Once we got to 1980, the variety show sort of fell out of favor. You had some variety shows, not many. You had Hee Haw, which lasted until the late 80s. You also had another future installment, Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell Sisters. But you also had something on NBC called Pink Lady. And Jeff. And you're saying, well, why are you calling it Pink Lady and sort of putting "and Jeff" in parentheses? Well, that's a story.
Well, if we're going to tell the story, why don't we go back a bit?
Let's go back. Oh, that's another future installment. So let's go back to Fred Silverman, who, as we mentioned previously, passed away within the last month or so. He was watching Walter Cronkite, and they had an interest piece on a rock duo in Japan named Pink Lady. And he wanted to do a variety show with them. Now, all he saw was supposedly just like the concert footage, you know, just your normal human interest piece that would be on the news in the last like 5 minutes. And he immediately wanted to bring them over. More probably, I'm going to assume, because of their youth and also their looks. Not necessarily maybe for their musical talent. And the reason I say that is, do you know how many hits they had in the United States before they came over here?
One.
And I use the word hit very loosely. In August of 1979, they had a song, Kiss in the Dark. Do you know where it reached on the Billboard Hot 100?
I'm cheating here. Its peak position was number 37.
You cheated. It is number 37.
Oh.
So the thing is, I mean, when Casey Kasem does his countdown that week, number 37 is the fourth song played. So before the first commercial break, there's the song, and then it's gone, never to be heard from again. So Fred Silverman wanted to do a variety show with Pink Lady, and he needed somebody to sort of be the straight man, if you will. And who do they get? They get Jeff Altman. Now, you may be saying, who is Jeff Altman?
Mike, who is Jeff Altman?
That's a great question, Greg.
Yeah, I know it's a great question, Mike.
Well, Jeff Altman, he was actually really known in the 80s and 90s, and maybe even a little bit later, being a semi-frequent guest on the Letterman show, whether it was Late Night with David Letterman or The Late Show with David Letterman. He was also a comedian on Solid Gold.
Oh, okay. So he probably hung out with Marty Cohen backstage back in the day.
Yeah, him and Marty Cohen and probably Arsenio Hall, too, at some point. Yeah, exactly. And also, he was on the NBC series Nurses during its first season, if you remember Nurses. Pretty decent show back in the day.
I do remember Nurses, and that might be a part of a future installment down the line. Not a future installment in and of itself, but part of one. Part of one.
I didn't know what Nurses was.
You didn't know what Nurses was?
No.
Did you watch NBC on Saturday nights in the 80s?
I was probably about 5.
Yeah, he would have gone to sleep after the Golden Girls.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I guess I get that.
Yeah, I'm only here for Betty White and Bea Arthur, and that's it. I'm going to bed.
And then his parents said, oh, here comes 227. You're going to sleep, young man. So Fred Silverman had this brilliant idea for a variety show with Jeff Altman as the comedy and Pink Lady doing comedy as well, but also doing songs both in Japanese, their own songs, but also they were doing more standard Americanized hits. There's just one problem.
What's the problem, Mike?
Pink Lady couldn't speak English.
Mike, how can you have a variety show work if your two big stars can't speak any English?
Well, they would read on cue cards the phonetic version. So the best way of comparing it, I think, is sort of like Mr. Ed. You put peanut butter in Mr. Ed's mouth, and his mouth moves. And then you have a voice actor putting words into Mr. Ed's mouth. That doesn't necessarily mean Mr. Ed knows what he's saying. So by that logic, kind of, sort of, Pink Lady is just reading what's on the cards, and they have no idea what's coming out of their mouths. It could be funny. It could be blasphemous. Who knows? And also, it makes me wonder if maybe the music was done the same way. Because, again, well, I know there's, you know, foreign songs that, you know, we would know the lyrics to, but given that they were doing, you know, disco hits from the late 70s/early 80s, would they necessarily know what was being said in the lyrics, or would they necessarily remember the lyrics?
Well, that's funny that you should mention that, Mike. I know we always like to point out one podcast that was the inspiration for this podcast, Omnibus, in the episode about Milli Vanilli, when Ken and John are talking about Milli Vanilli, John Roderick in the episode brings up the fact that he once heard a Japanese band sing the theme song of the Dukes of Hazzard perfectly, and then when he went up to talk to them, they couldn't speak a word of English. They learned the entire lyrics to the Dukes of Hazzard song phonetically. They had mastered it to a science.
A 1-minute theme song is a little different than like a 3 or 4 minute pop song, but the point still stands. So who was Pink Lady? Chico, who was Pink Lady?
I'm glad you asked that question. Pink Lady is a J-pop duo from Japan during the 1970s, composed of me and Hey, that would be Mitsuo Nemoto and Keiko Masuda.
And they were essentially the equivalent to the Beatles over here. They were huge. And you could even see that in the first episode of Pink Lady and Jeff. There's footage being shown of them at a stadium where they're probably playing in front of, I'm guessing, about 100,000 people.
Big.
Very big. Humongous.
Huge.
Absolutely. And maybe they were a little too big for their britches, because their agents originally wanted to call the show Pink Lady. And, well, there's one issue. They had Jeff involved, and they wanted to get Jeff's name out there. So there was actually at one point a suggested title, which I'm not even kidding about this, was Pink Lady starring Me and Kay with Jeff Altman.
That's a little too cumbersome.
It's way too cumbersome. And then they just lopped off everything except Pink Lady. And then just over time, this wasn't even part of the show's real name, and Jeff was added.
Well, that's how it was marketed in, like, TV Guide and the trades and whatnot.
Yeah, even though there was threats of lawsuits from Pink Lady's legal team. They said, we want this to be Pink Lady only. You know, nothing about Jeff. We're focusing strictly on the Pink Lady. And, you know, when you look at it in ads, not necessarily TV ads, not commercials, but sometimes in print, it does say Pink Lady and Jeff. If you look at at different resources, it does call it Pink Lady, but often it's called Pink Lady and Jeff. I believe that's what the name of the DVD release is Pink Lady and Jeff. And, oh, yes, this is on DVD.
What? Are you kidding me?
It was released in 2001 by Rhino Entertainment. Now, how much it goes for, since it's now close to 20 years old, I couldn't tell you. But guess what? I'm going to find out.
Oh, boy.
Oh, jeez.
This is going to be fun.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Break out go into your retirement fund. There's one copy on eBay that I see, and it's $115.
Yeah.
And shipping is only $11.
Tell you right now, shipping is a steal.
Shipping is a bargain compared to that, absolutely. We should mention that one of the supporting players on Pink Lady and Jeff was Jim Varney, who you would better know as Ernest. Hey, Vern!
Hey, Vern. We're about to see the Japanese J-pop duo. Know what I mean?
Besides the obvious language barrier, there were a number of other issues with the show. Well, one of them is that once the jokes were written for the show, they really couldn't be changed because that would confuse or make life a little more troublesome, more of a burden for Pink Lady. So you had the jokes. If something happened between taping and the air date, you couldn't just throw in a new joke because you'd have to rewrite it and redo the whole phonetic spelling for the ladies. Yeah. And then also there was an incident where Lauren Green was on the show. They really spared no expense at getting good quality guests. We'll get to that in a moment or so. Lauren Green was on the show. The problem is Lauren Green agreed to be on the show literally hours before it recorded. So, again, you can't change any jokes. You can't change any dialogue for Pink Lady. You sort of have to go with the flow.
And how they did that, I have no idea.
Well, you just got to roll with the punches. You've already written the jokes. You can't do any sort of editing or modifying because that would be too much work on Pink Lady. Plus, also, they'd have to memorize or attempt to memorize if they didn't have the cue cards written up in phonetically. And I mean, I don't even know how they would do that unless they had like a Japanese translator on the set who could write the cue cards out. Could they read English characters off a cue card? I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing that would be a difficult transition to go from Japanese to a totally different type of writing. But also beyond that, obviously it just wasn't funny, but it was also very stereotypically racist. Do we have to go there again? We went through this with Banzai. Do we have to go through this again? Where to start with the racism, though? Because
how about the beginning?
Maybe we should say stereotyping. Where should we start with the stereotyping?
I think we should begin at the beginning, Mike,
We should begin at the beginning. Yes, Chico.
That was an intro to what was told to be a traditional Japanese number, and here are K and me in traditional kimonos.
Oh, but even before that, in the development of the show.
Oh, boy.
No, no, no.
Not
no.
That.
No.
Mike, what are you doing, Mike?
Oh, what are you going to say? I'm just scared. What are you going to say?
That the original idea that Sid and Marty Krofft came up with, or at least one of the Krofts, was that the show would be sort of set in like a Japanese box that opens up. And by Japanese box, I don't know if they mean a takeout box or if they mean a bento box or if there's some sort of Japanese art form of creating special boxes. But that was the original idea for how the show would be presented.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah.
But no, it goes beyond that. Not just the kimonos. Not just the joke that Jeff Altman said about wishing how he had the tempura concession at the concert. Instead of doing like a usual wipe, like there might be a star wipe or a wipe off the screen, one of the wipes that was used was an Oriental fan.
What?
Look for it.
Are you talking about a Tessen?
I'm talking about whatever the name of that fan is.
Yeah, that's a Tessen.
You'd know that more than I would.
I like Japanese stuff, what can I say?
But also, there were quite a few jokes about just Japanese culture, about incorporating the fact that me and Kay are from Japan. There is also a character, a somewhat recurring character, who was a sumo figure, a sumo wrestler. Sometimes he would bust through a wall. There were other times he'd appear at the end of the show, which we'll get to later in this broadcast. And yeah, it's just stereotyping and what would be considered just a little bit on the racist side.
So, but aside from all of this, it was just your standard run-of-the-mill average variety show with your standard run-of-the-mill average variety show usual suspects.
Yeah, but the one big thing is Sid and Marty Krofft were behind Donnie and Marie. Well, they were also behind the Brady Bunch variety hour. So it goes both ways there. But still, they had experience doing those types of shows. Plus, also, they were behind, again, future installment, Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell Sisters, which would come a year or two later. So they knew the variety format. They've done, at this point, at least two before, and you got Pink Lady and Jeff, and then they're going to do at least one more after that.
So it's not like they didn't know what they was doing.
They knew the key to success. Again, Donnie and Marie. That's all you need to say.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Also, at least from the episodes I saw, and I did see multiple episodes. I'm sorry about that. I wasted time watching these episodes. They did try creating some recurring characters and recurring, I don't want to say recurring plot lines necessarily, but they have repeating types of segments. One of the characters that Jeff Altman did was sort of like a schlocky art dealer named Art Nouveau. Art N-U-V-O.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah. And he was trying to sell cheap artwork, almost like out of the, not necessarily out of the back of his car, mind you, but in some sort of, cramped sort of place where we need to move all this now. We're going to do 80% off of this. And it just really wasn't funny. And as I said, they did have some bit players, one of whom was Jim Varney. He was interesting, to say the least. He was probably, at least humor-wise, the best part of the show.
It's not saying much.
It isn't saying much, but compared to the other people who were on the show, I mean, the other people on the show, I don't even know who they are. You have Sherry Steinkellner and Ed Nakamoto and Anna Matthias. Three people I've never heard of.
Who are three people who have never been in my kitchen.
And two people who don't even have a reference on Wikipedia, so that says quite a bit about them. And now the guests. As I mentioned earlier, Lorne Greene was on the show, but he literally agreed to being on the show hours, 3 hours, 4 hours before the show was recorded. So there was not much wiggle room in terms of changing the script.
It wasn't like they could make a Battlestar Galactica sketch.
No, no, not at all. In the first episode, the guests were Burt Parks, Sherman Hemsley, and Blondie.
Interesting thing about that, because apparently Blondie didn't have any involvement with the show whatsoever. They just showed the video.
That's actually the point I was going to make, and this doesn't just apply to Blondie. It applies to at least one other musical guest, is they weren't on the show per se. They just aired a music video done by the artist.
Remember, guys, MTV isn't until August of 81.
Right, yeah, we're still almost a year and a half away from MTV at this point. So Blondie was not there in person. It was a music video, specifically Shayla by Blondie. I mentioned earlier that Pink Lady did a number of songs, some of their own songs in Japanese, some actual hits on the radio at the time. Looking at the first episode, some of the songs that were performed by Pink Lady, Boogie Wonderland, Turn Up the Radio, Stop in the Name of Love, You've Got a Friend, Knock on Wood, and Don't Stop. How many of those were actually Pink Lady songs? I think the number would be maybe one or zero.
I think that the answer would be none, to be honest.
Yeah. If anything, one, I believe, was the theme song to the television series, and that would be Turn Up the Radio.
And we know what Stop in the Name of Love is. We know what You've Got a Friend is. Don't Stop. Knock on Wood. We know all those. And Boogie Wonderland just doesn't come across as a song that would have probably played in Japan. And no, it didn't, because it was a song by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
I'll be honest, they would have been much better off if they played Shining Star, to be honest.
No, y'all, sing a song. They gotta put, if you're gonna cover an Earth, Wind, and Fire song, you gotta cover Sing a Song.
Episode 1, not necessarily was so bad, but the ratings were so disastrous that NBC moved it from its Saturday night time slot just after one episode to Friday nights. So episode 2 actually aired almost 2 weeks later on March 14th of 1980. And the guests for that show were Larry Hagman, Sid Caesar, Donny Osmond, and Teddy Pendergrass. And again, I can only imagine the amount of money it took to get Larry Hagman on that show. And again, from what I've read, a lot of money was paid to the celebrities to appear on the show. Because remember, at this time, Larry Hagman would have been a huge celebrity on a little show called Dallas that aired on another network.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And supposedly, from what I heard, a lot of the budget actually went towards the celebrities. Because Larry Hagman would not have been cheap. Even Sid Caesar, given his legendary status, I know it's 1980, but still, he's a legend. He may not come cheap.
How much was Teddy Pendergrass making around this time?
I imagine a lot.
Yeah, Teddy Pendergrass back in 1980 would have been doing pretty well. And even Donny Osmond, again, I know he had the relationship with the Crofts that I mentioned earlier, but Donny Osmond couldn't have been terribly cheap either.
Oh, no.
And he was reasonably young. He would have only been, what, maybe about 20 at the time?
He might have been early, mid-20s at this point.
Oh, yeah. He was definitely no older than maybe 22 or 23. So looking at the songs that that were performed on that show by Pink Lady. Ease On Down the Road. Not one of their songs. Turn Up the Radio. Heaven Knows, performed by Donny Osmond and Pink Lady.
Oh, that was great.
That was a good one. We Are Family by Donny Osmond and Pink Lady, which you could almost write the jokes right there about We Are Family with Donny Osmond.
Do you think they were all wearing Pittsburgh Pirates hats?
They should have. Willie Stargell should have come out and started singing with them.
Nope. Instead, we get Teddy Pendergrass. Oh, well.
Well, Teddy Pendergrass, he definitely had something for the ladies that night. I'll just say that much.
Oh!
That's right. Ooh. If you've seen the footage, yeah. I mean, he was doing like...
I saw the footage.
It was like televised fellatio to the ladies. But I'm not wrong, though.
No.
And then you had 42nd Street by Donny Osmond and Pink Lady, and On Broadway with Teddy Pendergrass and Pink Lady. So again, none of their original songs showed up. Oh, I'm still trying to recover from how bad that was.
I'm still trying to recover from the Teddy Pendergrass footage.
Oh, I'm still having hot flashes over that. All right, episode 3. The guests on this episode were Greg Evigan.
Oh, Greg Evigan of future entry, BJ and the Bear.
I was going to say My Two Dads, but whatever. And some guy named Hugh Hefner and Cheap Trick. But wait!
What?
Cheap Trick, they showed a video. They showed the video for Dream Police. So again, just like Blondie, Cheap Trick was not there performing. They literally mailed it in. Mailed a video.
So you're saying that Cheap Trick performed a Cheap Trick?
Yeah!
Quoting my good friend Dino Alexander, Greg, go to your room.
Yeah, Hugh Hefner was not alone on this episode, though.
Oh, he was not alone.
Not in the slightest.
In one of the skits, he was joined by, must have been about 5 or 6 of his Playboy buddies. I think it was like 5 or 6.
Yeah.
There were new recruits who were becoming Playboy bunnies, and guess who they were? Me and Kay. And hey, let's add in a little sexual humor, because me and Kay were going to be bunnies, except they felt a little, let's say, inadequate, because their bosoms were small. And they looked at the girls, and they looked down at their chests and like, no, we're not Playboy bunnies, because we have small boobs.
There's another one of those unfunny racist sexist jokes.
And we thought the biggest boob on that show was Jeff Altman.
Hey-o!
Oh.
But interesting thing, they did sing one of their original songs.
Yes, they did!
What? It took until like 3 shows for them to sing an original song?
Yep.
Tell the man, Chico.
They open the show with a song called UFO. Or
UFO, yeah. Not UFO.
No, seriously, it was called UFO. I'm looking at the pronunciation on Wikipedia, Truth by Consensus. UFO.
He's right, folks. I can't believe it.
When I lie to you people, oh my god.
Not to our faces. but then you had other songs that night. You had Greg Evigan singing, People I Know I Want to Be Around. And then him and Pink Lady together did Don't Go Breaking My Heart. With Greg Evigan doing the Elton John role, presumably, but then Kiki D was being done by Pink Lady. I want to see that, folks.
He's going to go see that now.
Looking to see that now. And here's episode 4. Here's the Lorne Greene episode. Lorne Greene. Oh, again, Sid Caesar, Florence Henderson, and guess who came back? "Quote unquote came back." Blondie.
Oh, Blondie's
back.
Blondie's back, Mike.
Blondie's back. And, well, back in terms of we mailed in another music video. Could you please air it? Because MTV won't be around for another 17 months. I saw bits and pieces of this episode, and it's like all the rest of them. It's just not that good. Florence Henderson, I really didn't care for. She did sing, though.
Yeah, she did like a melody of "My Old Kentucky Home," "Back Home Again in Indiana," and "America the Beautiful." It was like the only reason why you would know one of those songs if you were a Straight No Chaser fan. "Back Home Again in Indiana," because they're from Indiana.
Yeah, and she sang for like a good 8 to 10 minutes. And I'm sorry, my finger got hurt trying to hit the fast forward button on the YouTube video. I don't want to see Florence Henderson singing.
She's a good singer.
Oh, I'm taking nothing away from her. I just I don't care about 8 minutes of singing.
Yeah, I don't want to hear Carol Brady sing for about 8 minutes. I'm sorry.
Thank you for the support, Greg. And Pink Lady, and I don't think Pink Lady did a single one of their songs here. "You Keep Me Hanging On," clearly not Pink Lady. "Yesterday," clearly not a Pink Lady song. "How Deep Is Your Love," clearly not a Pink Lady song. "Shame," not a Pink Lady song, I'm sorry. And "La Freak," definitely not a Pink Lady song. No, definitely not, definitely not, definitely not. In episode 5... the guest stars were Jerry Lewis, Red Buttons, who was probably a little bit past his expiration date at that point.
You think?
I know. And Alice Cooper. Boy, those are three names that you'd never think you'd hear together in the same sentence. Jerry Lewis, Red Buttons, and hey, here's Alice Cooper. Why not? And Alice Cooper actually performed at this show. It was not mailed in. And again, this is just, again, painful. I saw some of the Red Button stuff, just not funny. And clearly, this almost sounds like a last gasp effort to save the show, because Alice Cooper definitely would have brought in the younger eyes. But then at the same time, you've got Jerry Lewis, who would have been probably 55 at the time. I don't think he was doing anything major outside of the telethon every year at that point.
No, in fact, he would be about 5 or 6 years removed from Future Installments, The Jerry Lewis Show.
And Red Buttons, oh my gosh, I mean, he was easily probably about a good 15 to 20 years past
his use by date.
His use by date. Well, that's not necessarily the wrong phrase to use, but yeah, his shelf life expired about 15 years earlier. And some of the songs. Oh my gosh, Pink Lady sang another one of their songs. That's 2 in 5 episodes. "Monster." It was number 1 for 8 weeks in Japan, and it sold 1.6 million copies.
And along with UFO, it was the only 2 songs of Pink Lady's that they performed.
And then they sang MacArthur Park. That would have been interesting to hear them sing MacArthur Park.
I'm sorry, but Gilbert Gottfried did it better on his podcast.
And then, here's the... Okay, this is a threesome. I get like a little bit of the connection between the first two, but the third one, I'm sorry. "Do You Think I'm Sexy," "Dancing Queen," and then the one that just doesn't fit this at all, "If My Friends Could See Me Now." It's another one of those 3-song medleys like Florence Henderson did, but you've got "Do You Think I'm Sexy" and "Dancing Queen," 2 disco era hits from the late 70s. And then you've got "If My Friends Could See Me Now" from the musical Sweet Charity. Shoulder shrug here.
Well, Linda Clifford actually did record a disco version of "If My Friends Could See Me Now" in 1978.
Problem is, this episode isn't out there as far as I know, so We don't know if it was a disco version or a straight-up version or what. And as I said, Alice Cooper was actually in studio and performed Clones, We're All.
And then we kind of freaky.
It was Alice Cooper. Everything was kind of freaky about him back in the day. And then the unaired episode.
Oh.
The unaired episode. Now, this one I may have wanted to watch back in the day. Roy Orbison. And say what you will about him being past his expiration date. Roy Orbison is timeless.
He is timeless.
And
he's eight years away from Traveling Wilburys.
At this point, he would have been like 7 or 8 years away from Traveling Wilburys. You're right. And then Bobby Vinton, Sid Caesar again, and some young kid who would go on to own the Weather Channel named Byron Allen.
Who that guy be?
He was on some NBC show. Oh, more corporate synergy with NBC. Some NBC show called Real People.
Oh, I bet that didn't last.
No, it didn't last long at all. Never heard of it. And this and the music on this show included Sugar Pie Honey Bunch or I Can't Help Myself. Again, not a Pink Lady song. Crazy Little Thing Called Love. Again, not a Pink Lady song. And then him and Johnny B. Goode, a medley performed by Bobby Vinton and Pink Lady. And yeah, Bobby Vinton was actually there in the studio. He did a number of songs. He did more than Pink Lady that night, apparently. He did Roses Are Red, My Love, Blue on Blue, Love How You Love Me, Sealed with a Kiss, Blue Velvet, all five in a medley. So we complain about Florence Henderson singing for like 8 minutes. Bobby Vinton probably went for at least 10. He did the medley, him and Johnny B. Goode with Pink Lady.
Yeah, but if you've ever heard him and if you've ever heard Johnny B. Goode, they don't go together.
No, they don't.
Yeah, not as good as Marvin Berry and the Starlighters version.
And then Roy Orbison, gosh, I hope he did some comedy here, because the only thing it says in terms of music that he did was Oh Pretty Woman, I mean, his seminal hit. But then you actually had Jeff Altman doing two songs.
No.
He sang the Bobby Vinton song, Mr. Lonely, how appropriate. And he also did Blue on Blue with Bobby Vinton.
Well.
Yeah. Who knew he could sing? He definitely wasn't great at comedy. No, I shouldn't say that.
No, that's mean.
That's very mean.
He gave it the good old college. He gives it the good old college try.
And one thing we haven't mentioned at this point, the end of the show. At the end of every show, and Pink Lady says, this is a Japanese tradition, which, I'm sorry, I call shenanigans on this. They would go into a hot tub.
No.
So what would happen is, me and Kay, at least on the first episode, they would go behind a Japanese silk screen. Boy, again, more stereotyping. They would undress with their silhouettes being shown through the screen and just getting all giddy looking and whatnot. And here come me and Kay wearing kimonos or robes. And when they say, we're going to do this Japanese tradition we do after every yes. show or whatnot, they take off their robes and they're wearing skimpy bikinis. And they go to this hot tub, which is in the back of the set. They reveal the hot tub by opening essentially what looks like, again, more stereotyping, Japanese screen doors. And there's the hot tub. And they go in and they say, oh, Jeff, it's nice and warm in here. Come join us. And Jeff, meanwhile, is wearing a tuxedo. And he's wearing leather shoes. He's dressed to the nines. And no, I can't go in there because I'm wearing, this tuxedo and these nice shoes. "Oh, but come on, Jeff." And they slowly, you know, lure him in, and he puts a couple feet into the hot tub, you know, ruining his shoes. And then within a few seconds, he's neck deep in the hot tub, tuxedo's totally soaked. And the girls sort of kind of start undressing him, taking off his tie and taking off his jacket. You know, "Oh, you need to relax, Jeff." They did variations of that on at least a couple of episodes. The second episode, they were just in like kimonos or robes and just stripped down to the bikinis and went to the hot tub. Again, with Jeff showing signs of trepidation, saying, "No, no, no, I'm going to stay here. I don't want to get this tuxedo ruined." But by episode five, I believe this is episode five, the last aired episode, me and Kay were going to do the hot tub scene, but where's Jeff? And guess what? Jeff was in the hot tub already in a bathing suit, just relaxing, chilling. And remember the sumo guy I mentioned earlier?
Was he also in the tub?
He was in the tub, but he was like underwater, and there was a joke being made about sharks. And guess what came up? A dorsal fin. And Jeff ran out of the hot tub wearing just his bathing suit. And here's the sumo guy. He stands up. He's laughing. Tee-hee-hee. And that's all we saw of Pink Lady and Jeff on NBC until Rhino Entertainment decided to release this on DVD over 20 years later. It was a mess. I mean, you can sort of see the writing on the wall when, as I said, it started on March 1st of 1980, a Saturday night, and within one episode got moved to Friday nights. That's not good.
No.
So what can I say except Pink Lady went back to Japan. They made some more music.
I'm going to stop you right there, Chico. They actually broke up a little bit after this. I think it was
really?
1980. Yeah, it was like 1981 or 82. But they did reunite about 10 years ago.
Aww.
They were on some sort of like reunion tour or something like that. So they did officially break up like in 81 or 82. I don't know whether they went their own ways or whether they... when I say went their own ways in terms of doing solo music, or if they did TV, they went in different careers. But they did reunite, from what I read, sometime around 2010, 2011, and did some touring at that point. So they did go back to music.
Woohoo! Jeff Altman would end up being another one of those people that we say, "It's that guy from that thing."
It's that guy from Letterman.
Yep. He was
seriously.
Fun fact, he played Slimer on The Real Ghostbusters.
Wow.
And as for the sumo, well, who knows what happened to that guy.
Yeah.
But what could you say except music variety acts, comedy bits, and overt racism? Yeah, you would not be having any of that in 2020. But in 1980, it was a thing on TV.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over two dozen podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Episode 37, Submission 388, Video Games Based on TV Shows. So, guys, I know, like me, you guys enjoy your video games.
Yes.
I know Chico's a big gamer. He loves his Nintendo games. And I know Greg enjoys his video games, as do I. And I'm sure over the courses of our lifetimes, we've all encountered a very bad TV video game or two, or in this case, in this episode, more than two. As far as I can tell, the first TV show that became a video game was in 1983. The TV show MASH, which actually would have probably shown its final episode by this time, they had an Atari 2600 game, which I'm not going to cover today because it's sort of a fun game. But we have many worse video games, and I'm going to defer to Chico to start off this episode.
Okay.
What video game would you like to talk about first?
I'm going to talk about one of the earliest video games I played in the 90s on both the NES and the Super NES. In 1991, we had the NES version of American Gladiators. Which, if you remember, in 1991, the American Gladiators were just starting to become this big thing on the weekends. They're just, you know, people are just watching. Everybody is wearing spandex and throwing balls and whacking each other with overgrown Q-tips. But it looks really cool, so I'm gonna watch. So Game Tech, as they usually do with game shows like this, they made a video game of it. But here's the thing. Their first shot at a video game of it was absolutely... I didn't know what to make of it. For example, it had six of the events. The first five were Powerball, Joust, Human Cannonball, The Wall, and Assault. It played like combat. And then Powerball looked at least a little bit like the show. It was show faithful. At least the second half of the first season. Human Cannonball had a stationary swing where you had to not swing at one gladiator, but a successive line of gladiators. The Wall had, like, one of those never-ending walls instead of just the wall from the TV show. It just looked like a series of handholds and whatever and what have you. And the gladiators weren't just coming from below you. They were coming from beside you and above you. But the perhaps the most accidentally funny thing of this game was the Joust. And if you've played it, you know what I'm about to talk about. There's a bunch of pillars. There's not one pillar. There's a line of successive pillars. And on each one, you have to knock off a gladiator. And when you do knock off a gladiator, they let out this incredibly loud, incredibly funny, incredibly off-sounding, digitized scream. Like, ah! And it was just weird. But yeah, it did. And after those five events, you think you were done and you were off to the eliminator, right? No, sir. you have to do those again and again and again and again until at least four or five times in succession. Then you get to the Eliminator, which didn't look so much like the Eliminator course on the screen on the TV show. It just looked like something out of Mega Man. But yeah, a bunch of pillars, a bunch of balls you're trying to dodge, slides for life, a bunch of travelators, and a bunch of what are those things? Hand bikes. It would pass for a passable sort of shovelware action game, generic action game for the Nintendo, and nobody would be the wiser. But they decided to put the American Gladiator's name on it. Ultimately, they would get it right with another set of developers for the Super Nintendo, Genesis, and Amiga versions, with more show faithful presentation. But there was one problem: the controls.
Oh yeah,
the controls.
Bad on the SNES version.
Yeah, they were incredibly bad on the SNES version. You would think that it would be easy, just put some controls on your D-pad. No, you have to hit the L and R triggers over and over again. And I'm like, why am I doing this?
The one takeaway I have from the American Gladiators game for the SNES version, doing the wall was immensely difficult, because now the wall wasn't just a straight shot up. You had to zigzag, you had to go to the left, and you had to have your arm holes in exactly the right place, or your finger holes. You had to have your fingers holding exactly the right spot. If you're even like one little bit off, you'll fall off the wall. It was a horrible, horrible, absolutely horrible rendition of the wall. And as far as I know, that wasn't the version that had gladiators coming in from all directions trying to get you, even from above. It was basically like the TV show, but the thing is, if you made one little mistake, if you're off by a centimeter, game's over.
Yep. The music was pretty impressive, though. But, yeah, I mean, give them props for trying to capture the feel of the actual show for the 1993 Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, and Amiga releases, but still needed. They were still rushing to release this while the iron was hot, let's just say.
The only playable level was Powerball.
And Atlasphere.
I agree with that.
And Atlasphere. Don't forget Atlasphere.
Atmosphere was great.
That was American Gladiators. I have a bigger disappointment than American Gladiators, and this one, back in the day, we're talking similar time era, maybe a little bit earlier. This was a huge disappointment for me as a kid. I'm talking specifically about Funhouse, both for the PC and also for the NES.
Yeah, I remember the Funhouse NES game. That's basically the people at High Tech Expressions freely admitting we didn't see 1 minute of this TV show.
Well, beyond that even, you had stunts to start off with, but the problem is the stunts were absolutely impossible to do. And for a number of stunts, I remember you had to like get your coordinates timed exactly right. Like you had like an X coordinate and a Y coordinate if you wanted to throw something, or if you had if you're throwing something, you had to determine like not just how fast you wanted to throw it, but also like the launch angle. And it was just incredibly difficult. And that's just the main game. Going to the Funhouse, this still makes me mad 30-some years later. You see the Funhouse on TV show. Oh, good, we're going to run through the Funhouse. We're going to go through through the pressure cooker, and we're going to go up the mountain, and we're going to do all this stuff. Oh, absolutely not. It was almost like roller skating, and you had to get, I'm going to say icons or coins. And actually, it depended on the version of the video game. For the PC version, you had to get all the items in the funhouse or each room. I believe you had to get all of a certain type of item. So that means, you know, you don't want to, you know, grab any of the bad items. You only want to get the ones that you need. So you'd have to go around them. And it was a giant maze. And that was really no fun, but it didn't compare to the NES version. The NES version was actually like, I'd almost say somebody roller skating or inline skating through, I don't even know how to describe it, through a, like an industrial zone almost, trying to get these numbered coins, and you had to get them in order, and the controls were so absolutely horrific, the game was almost impossible to beat. And it's somewhere on YouTube, but somebody did beat that game. I mean, there were a certain number of levels. It may have been dozens. And by dozens, I mean, it may have been 50 levels. It might have been 60 levels. But somebody actually went through and beat all the levels and actually defeated the game. And it's just such a disappointment, because you're expecting something authentic from the TV show, especially since I would have been like 13 or 14 when this was released. And then you sort of got the bait and switch. Oh, well, here, you're going to have to inline roller skate through this industrial zone, picking up these coins in the proper order, picking up coin one, then coin two, then coin three. And you need to do it in a certain amount of time. Plus, also, the controls for skating are absolutely horrible.
They're very slippery.
Such a disappointment. I mean, at least Double Dare, which is not going to be on today's show, at least Double Dare for the NES and for the PC, at least they got it right in terms of having a true obstacle course, even if that is near impossible to defeat.
Yeah, you need to have like an NES Turbo controller to at least beat that.
Yeah, but that might be a future episode. Greg, there's something you want to talk about.
Okay, well, the first game I'm going to discuss is WWF Betrayal for the Game Boy Color from 2001 by THQ. Now, guys, you would think, okay, this is going to be a WWF game. This is going to be about wrestling, right?
Right.
Right.
Well, guess what, guys? This game isn't about wrestling.
It's not about wrestling.
But it's got the WWF moniker.
There's wrestlers and everything. Why isn't it about wrestling?
Okay, let me explain. So the plot of this game is it's like River City Ransom, but with WWF characters.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, yes. So you have to pick one of four WWF wrestlers. You can either pick Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, Triple H, or The Undertaker. So what happens is Stephanie McMahon is kidnapped, and Vince McMahon's like, "Hey, pal, I need you to go and find Stephanie McMahon. And if you can find Stephanie McMahon, I'll give you a WWF title shot." So you have to go into these bunch of stages where you have to fight various wrestlers. You have to fight backstage or in a parking garage or in the subway. And then finally, it concludes at Titan Towers, the WWF headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut. So I'm going to reenact the four different versions of this ending, okay? So okay, guys, spoilers, plot line. It turns out that it was all a trick by Vince McMahon. He fooled them. Stephanie McMahon was never kidnapped. It turns out it was all a ruse by Vince McMahon. So here's the first version with Stone Cold Steve Austin. "What? I knew I couldn't trust you. Stephanie was never kidnapped. You let Triple H steal my title, and then you sent me on a wild goose chase. Don't trust anyone. Isn't that your motto, Austin? Triple H, you and Stephanie, get to the roof." Triple H gets to the roof of Stephanie. "Mr. McGrann, I'll handle this." Austin, I'm gonna run you down. And then, oh God. And then you go on the rooftop, and then Triple H is like, so Austin, you made it through the Undertaker. I bet you the heavyweight title that you can't make it through me, Austin. I'll just read a little bit of Austin 316 after that. Now I'm the heavyweight champion, and that's the bottom line because Stone Cold says so. So yeah, you win the WWF title. Now here's the version with The Rock. What's this? The Rock smells a rat. Why would you, Vince McMahon, kidnap your own daughter? Mr. McMahon. Listen, people's chump, and listen good. We've all had enough of you and your eyebrow. Stephanie was never kidnapped. We just wanted to distract you long enough to get away. Triple H, you and Stephanie, get on the roof. Mr. McMahon, I'll take care of The Rock. Rock. You'll take care of The Rock? How are you going to do that? And then Rock beats Mr. McMahon. And then Triple H is like, so, Rock, you just beat him through The Undertaker. I'll bet you that... the same crap he says before. And then The Rock says, once again, The Rock is the people's champ and the heavyweight champ. And then we go with The Undertaker is... a setup. I should have known. Stephanie was never kidnapped. You kept me running around while you and Triple H ran off with hell. So Dead Man Inc. has figured things out. Triple H, you and Stephanie get to the roof. I'll handle this. You and what army? And then The Undertaker beats Triple H on the roof. And he's like, when you step in The Undertaker's yard, you better be ready to lose. Now for the Triple H version, how could it be... How could Triple H have been the one to kidnap Stephanie, you think? Well, it turns out that Stone Cold Steve Austin was in on the ruse with Vince McMahon. Because this was in the period where, if you remember, probably Chico, when Stone Cold Steve Austin in 2001 was a heel.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's it. So Triple H's like, Vince, what's going on? What are you doing here, Mr. Van?
What does it look like, Triple H? You and Stephanie have been walking around here like acting like... you own the place. Well, I own the place. And I think Austin is a much better champ than you. Stone Cold, get Stephanie up to the roof. Come on, Triple H. Let's see how you handle dear old dad.
Triple H, I'm going to break you in two. And then after Triple H beats Steve Austin on the roof, he's like, if you play the game, you'll lose. Come on, Stephanie. Let's get out of here. That's how this nightmare for Triple H ends. He's like, if you play the game, you'll lose. Now, Stephanie, let's get out of here. That's the end of the game.
Oh, boy. That is about as rippy as you can. You might as well have named your kids Ryan and Alex or something. Because, yeah, that was like a direct clone of River City Ransom. Right down to the kidnapping your woman sort of angle.
I'm sort of wondering where Alan Thicke came into play there.
Guys, blame Kevin Mahan for that version of Triple H.
I'm still blaming Alan Thicke. Hey guys, did you see me at Match Game Hollywood Squares this week?
Get lost.
Did you see my ex-wife Glory Luring at the 30?
Next up, while we're on that era of gaming, let's go to about, let's say it was about 2003, where we have American Idol in the midst of perhaps its greatest season ever. And thus, I'm talking about, of course, season 2. This is important because later that summer would be American Idol, the video game. Where you work your way up the ranks to become the next great singing superstar. There's just one problem.
Oh?
Yes. There's no singing to be had.
That sort of defeats the purpose.
How can you have an American Idol game with no singing, Chico? That makes no sense.
That's Codemasters. They're the ones who developed and released this thing. Actually, that's a lie. Codemasters published it, but it was developed by Hot House Creations for PS2, Windows, and PS2 and Windows, and Mobius Entertainment for the Game Boy Advance. Yes, this was not a singing simulator. This was a rhythm game along the lines of DDR, Parappa the Rapper, or Rhythm Heaven, or Space Channel 5.
How do you have an American Idol game without singing, Chico?
I don't know. Ask Hot House Creations. They're the ones who did it for PS2 and Windows, and Game Boy Advance was done by Mobius Entertainment. But yeah, this was released as American Idol in the U.S. and in other property in other countries. It was released as Pop Idol, and yes, it did feature the likenesses and the voices of Simon Cowell and Randy Jackson. Not exactly sure about Paula Abdul. I mean, she was in the credits. You're working your way up the ranks from auditions to the Hollywood round to the semis to the live shows. And each stage gets harder and harder and harder and harder. And you basically have to do well enough to survive and get, quote, enough of the vote to stay until you get to the final round. Which, by the way, all of this does not feature Ryan Seacrest at all. Not even Brian Dunkelman at all.
Oh.
Poor Brian Dunkelman. Yeah.
He's probably busy doing future installment 3 South at the time.
So you're basically hitting a bunch of buttons at a time, and you have to hope you have enough of the public vote in order to win the game. Eventually, Konami, in their infinite wisdom, would be like, give me that license, you sons of brother, and would release the Karaoke Revolution series. And one of the games that they would release would be Karaoke Revolution Presents American Idol. That does involve singing, and it is very good. But this Codemasters game, the folks at X-Play gave this a 1 out of 5 for a reason.
If I wanted to play a game like that, I'm sorry. I'd rather play Parappa the Rapper, a great game. Oh, I love that game. Or I'd rather play Rhythm Heaven, another great game for the DS.
I'm sorry, but when Chico mentioned X-Play and then Mike said, if I want to play, I thought he was going to say something about Morgan Webb.
No.
Good.
In fact, let me just run through these scores. EGM gave it a 1.5 out of 10. IGN gave it a 4 out of 10. X-Play gave it a 1 out of 5. Metacritic aggregated a 41 out of 100. And the only reason why it was that high to begin with, because Game Informer, those little subguns, gave it a 6.25 out of 10. And anybody who knows anything about video games knows that Game Informer doesn't give any game less than a 6. Because they want to sell copies. Anyway.
Anyway, we're going to move on to another disappointing game from my childhood. Boy, my childhood is full of disappointment, wasn't it?
I'm not going there.
I'm glad you're not. I'll take the fall by myself. I'm going to talk about Alf the First Adventure. What this was, now there are a number of ALF video games. I definitely want to differentiate this from the other video games. There was a Sega Master System ALF video game, which is bad on its own merits, but we're not going to talk about that today. There are also a couple of ALF educational video games. There's one on thinking skills and one on math, but we're not going to talk about those either. No. We're going to talk about ALF the First Adventure, which is essentially like a platformer type of game. It's just it's very crappy. The premise of the Alf the First Adventure video game is you had to get parts to the spaceship, the Alf spaceship, which were scattered throughout the city, and you had to collect four cats that were on the loose throughout the city. But it is a little deeper than that, because you not only had to avoid Willie Tanner, who was the patriarch of the Tanner family on Alf, but you also had to avoid the dog catcher. Now, if you ran into Willie, he will take everything that you've worked hard for in that level, and he'd redistribute it throughout the city.
Who does he think he is? Bernie Sanders?
Oh, jeez. Let's not make this too political.
Yeah.
But then the dog catcher, he would essentially take a life. Now, I use the word take a life very loosely. If you got caught by the dog catcher three times, your game would be done. So not really a life, more like an opportunity. Because what the game said was that if the dog catcher caught you, Willie would only bail you out the first two times. The third time, the game's over. So now it doesn't sound too bad. Okay, collect cats, the four cats, and collect the two parts of the spaceship. That doesn't sound too bad. What's the catch, Mike?
What's the catch, Mike?
Well, also, in addition to the two spaceship parts and the four cats, you had to collect a key in order to get to the next level of play. But what the catch is, you had to do this all within 24 hours, not necessarily in real time. The seconds were a little faster than a normal second, but also in order to get the cats, you had to also eat a pizza. The pizza allowed you to catch the cats, but each pizza would only give you about 7 seconds to catch the cats. And the city itself, it was four separate screens. It was like a giant maze. But there were a number of dead ends. And so you had to sort of blindly travel from one section of the city to the other, or through the maze, if you will, to the other. You don't know what might be on the other end. You might have Willie or the dog catcher there. And obviously, you know, you'd lose an opportunity if the dog catcher catches you. But if Willie catches you, you lose all your stuff. But also, another frustrating thing about this, besides the whole 8 seconds or so, or 7 seconds to get the cats, everything but Alf moved at a very frantic pace. They didn't go at like one space per second. No, no, no. They were like very jittery back and forth, very fast moving. And you really had like very little time to react to get a cat, or to avoid Willie or the dog catcher. And just from experience, I don't think I ever got past the first level of this game. I think there were only maybe one or two times I got all four cats without Willie finding me or getting caught by the dog catcher. It was just extremely frustrating. The game, if you played it for more than about 5 minutes, you were lucky. If you got past the first level, you're beyond lucky. Kind of funny, since the name of the cat on Alf was Lucky.
Lucky.
Tee-hee-hee. It's just very frustrating. And, I mean, this, I don't know if this is meant for maybe older people. I mean, I was like 13 at the time this came out, or 12. And I just wonder, it's just, could this game have been better if maybe it was slowed down a little bit, so everything wasn't so frantic and like I said, the maze. Oh, and one thing about this maze, this town, it doesn't tell you where you can go to the next part of the town. So you might have like a street that you're on. You try going to the next part of town, to the next screen, and you can't go there because it's a dead end. it's just, it was horrible. And the thing is, I love Valve. It's one of my favorite TV shows from the late 80s. But this game, big thumbs down. It's an absolute shame. There was potential there, but the time just goes so fast. And I mean, everything is like fast, like almost like the computer processor was being timed too fast. If it was going at a slower pace, it might have been a more fun game. But no, Alpha's. There's a reason why Alpha's on our list, or at least on my list. Greg probably has a game that is just as bad or maybe even worse. Right, Greg?
Yes. You talk about mazes. Well, this game has plenty of mazes for you. It's Superman on Nintendo 64, as it's more commonly known, Superman 64. Diego, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I've heard of it.
Yes. So this is based on the Superman animated series on Kids WB. So, okay. So Lex Luthor has kidnapped Superman's friends into a virtual world. Now, what do you expect a Superman game would contain?
Maybe flying, maybe X-ray vision.
Flying, yes. Would you care to guess what he flies around for most of the game?
No idea.
He flies around. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, I can't even imagine.
He flies around a set of rings, which are a series of mazes that Lex Luthor has left for him. And you have to run around the rings in a certain time limit, or else you're kind of screwed and it's game over. And this is the problem. The flying in this game is so bad, you cannot navigate around the rings. And by the way, after the rings, you have to grab two cars that have bombs in a certain set of time limit, and you have to throw them away from the people in the city. But the controls and the flying after that are so bad. By the way, did I mention that this is only supposed to be like the first like part of many in the game? Most of the game is just Superman flying through rings, and then you do a bunch of side stuff in between, and it has controls that are so broken and so bad, and the level design is so terrible that sometimes it even breaks the game.
And this is in the late 90s? You said N64.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah. I'm not going to go in depth because the Angry Video Game Nerd did two reviews about the Superman 64 game, but it is regarded as one of the worst video games of all time. It is just absolutely so bad. And for it to be attached to such a great series like the Superman animated cartoon from the 90s.
I mean, it must be really bad when Angry Video Game Nerd does two videos on it.
That's bad.
Oh, yeah.
That's really, really bad.
It is, yeah.
But I bet you it isn't as bad as a really generic Grand Theft Auto clone.
Okay, I'm listening. You had me at Grand Theft Auto.
I had you at Grand Theft Auto. So you would say you are a big fan of the Grand Theft Auto.
I've loved the Grand Theft Auto series since the original version came out in the late 90s. Yes.
Well, how about Pimp My Ride, the video game?
Okay, what? How does Pimp My Ride, what does that have to do with Grand Theft Auto? Okay, I'm listening.
Okay, so it was released on the Wii, the Xbox 360, the PSP, and the PS2. You are a customizer, and you have to go around customizing or pimping other people's rides with the help of course, because this is Pimp My Ride, you have to go around with the help of Mr. X to the Z himself, Exhibit. So all you have to do is collect your ride, go collect some auto parts, customize your ride and then deliver it to your customer. But it all has to be done within a time limit. And this is where the whole Grand Theft Auto thing comes in, because it is very much a free city. It's completely, you can drive anywhere and everywhere. In fact, I played this. I made the mistake of playing this, and I got Shades of Crazy Taxi from it, which is an infinitely better game than this, by the way, Crazy Taxi. And, gosh, what can I say except, I can tell that Exhibit was getting paid adequately for this.
Yeah, between this and that one NFL Street game he was in around this time.
Yeah, in an age of Grand Theft Auto clones, this is just in a class by itself. What can I say?
See, I'm now that I'm thinking about it, I love Grand Theft Auto.
Uh huh.
I love Crazy Taxi, but my gosh, this just. Was Pimp My Ride even popular enough to merit a video game?
Oh, it was.
It was a big show back in the day.
Now, I know it was a big show, but it's just when I think of MTV properties from 15 years ago, Pimp My Ride, maybe Pimp My Ride would be the best for a video game, but I also think of Cribs. I think of Jersey Shore. I couldn't even imagine a Jersey Shore video game. So you know what? Maybe in retrospect, maybe it was best they did a Pit My Ride video game.
Well, it could have been worse, Mike. We could have gotten a 16 and pregnant video game.
Oh, gee whiz, no.
Well, okay. I'll just sum it up here, because again, you gotta go around, do mini games, get money, then you can pimp somebody's rides, and you have to do it all in a time limit. Now,
well, yeah, it does sound like Crazy Taxi. That's what it really does sound like.
It does sound like Crazy Taxi.
And the Simpsons clone called Simpsons Road Rage, which also equally good.
Yep. Alex Navarro of GameSpot pretty much sums up my thoughts. It has a nauseatingly choppy frame rate. The game crashes on a semi-regular basis. There is no version of Pimp My Ride worth recommending to anyone, but the PSP version is definitely the one that should be most actively avoided. Now, you would think that, as bad as this game is, that, you know, they'd release it as shovelware and that would be the end of it, right?
You'd hope.
Yes.
They released a sequel for it in 2009.
Oh, jeez.
What? There's another one?
There's another one.
No.
It's called Pimp My Ride Street Racing for PS2 and the Nintendo DS.
I can't believe the PS2 still had new games out in freaking 2009.
It surprised me, too. Surprised me, too. But, yeah, Pimp My Ride. Why? Why, Activision? Why? But I'm sure Mike could do a whole lot worse than that.
Well, Chico, you said, can Mike do better? I'm going to try my best. I want to talk about Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Now, the games themselves, the quality of the games may not have been the best in terms of graphics. The questions were just fine. But I'm going to talk specifically about one version, and this is a not frequently seen version for the 3DS that was released when the revival appeared on Fox around 2015.
Okay.
This is a game that's really difficult to screw up. I mean, what do? You take this test, you have 10 questions. If you get them all right, you go for the $1 million question, right?
That seems simple enough.
Yeah, you can't really ruin that. Well, guess what?
What?
Oh, no.
What is it? What happened?
There's a couple of things. First, this game was apparently rushed to get on the streets, because I think I remember this being in stores not too long after the revival debuted. But first, the music is all generic. You don't have the kids singing the fifth grader theme like the previous versions of the game did. It was just generic music.
Oh, that's the best part, the kids singing.
I agree. The sound effects were generic. The background music was generic. The game itself is fine. It's the same game that we know and love. You got the copy, you got the peak, you've got the different grade levels, and you got the students to help you out. But where it gets a little wacky is your prize money. You actually get prize money you can use within the game. This is sort of like an RPG type of thing. You can reinvest the money you won on the show back into your school by either increasing the levels of certain core subjects, social studies, language arts, science, math. And when you increase those levels, you have smarter students who can help you out on the cheats and the copies and all that. But also you can put them in extracurricular activities. I'm not joking about that. So, for example, you can use your money to host a math Olympiad. You can also use your money to start a spelling bee at the school. You could have a debate tournament. There's also science fairs and academic decathlons. And you can use your money to buy these items, at least in theory. And what do I mean by in theory? Well, I actually have my 3DS in front of me, and I have my copy of Are You Smarter with a Fifth Grader in the game. Yes, I was one of those idiots who paid money for this. Not a lot, but I was still paid money for this. And if I want to purchase the academic decathlon, it would cost me $27,000, but there's one problem. Your classmates aren't interested in this event right now. Try unlocking some more classmates to try this event with.
Huh?
Well, another problem is, as far as I know, I've unlocked all the classmates. I've got all the students up to the highest level, level 25, and there's 30 students on here, and from what I can tell, all 30 are unlocked. I don't see a typical lock on their faces or anything like that. But also, in addition to this, not just winning money in the video game, it actually accumulates a certain amount of money every second or so when you're not playing the video game. So taking a look at my game right now, the game gives me 131 virtual dollars per about 2 seconds. I've had this game since 2015, as I mentioned earlier, since it first came out. And I don't want to say I can't purchase anything for my school or any students. But right now, and this is actually the number that's on the screen right now, how much I've earned and can't even spend in this game. And I do wish that this was real money so I could transfer it to my school in real life, because we'd be like eating caviar for the rest of our lives. Currently in my game, I have accumulated $4,107,335,000, and it just keeps on adding. And that's $4,107,335,000 I can't spend. So it's sort of like a game show mixed a little with like an RPG kind of, sort of, but, you know, when you can't really add anything to make the game better or spend the credits you've accrued, that sort of, you know, that sort of defeats the purpose of doing this. But yeah, this is a very poorly made game, very rushed. Because like I said, there's no music. I don't even think there's much of a Jeff Foxworthy voice outside of him saying, like, correct or right or yes. So they're just trying to get this out and make a fast buck. Well, they got a few of my bucks, but this is absolutely abysmal. But as bad as this is, Greg, we saved the best for last.
Yes, Mike, we saved the best for last. It is Home Improvement for the Super Nintendo, or as this version is called, Home Improvement Power Tool Pursuit. Now, the plot of this game is, on a special broadcast of Tool Time, Tim is prepared to unveil a new Binford Tools Ultra Power Line tool that is named after him. The Binford Taylor Turbo Power Tool Line. So right when Tim is about to unveil the tool, his tool case is empty. So Tim has to go and find the missing tools. So where are the tools, you ask? The tools are scattered around the studio. So how can you make a game out of that?
How do you make a game out of that?
Thank you, guys. Well, here's what happens. The first level is a dinosaur level where a dinosaur shows being shot. So what happens? Tim is fighting pterodactyls who are shooting eggs after him.
What?
Yes.
Pterodactyls.
Yes.
Shoot
and then he's fighting. Yes. And then he's fighting like all sorts of various dinosaurs. So he gets that. And then the next part of the game is he has to get the second power tool in the second level. And he's got to fight a mummy's tomb. Okay. Where he's got to fight all sorts of traps like it's the Temple of Doom or something. And then who does he fight in the boss fight in level two? A mummy.
Pterodactyls and a mummy.
Yes, but here's the next part, okay? The next part is he has to go into Dracula's lair. He's got to fight ghosts.
Now you're just making this up.
No, I'm not kidding. He's fighting ghosts, he's fighting bats, he's fighting spiders. And who does he face at the end of level three, you ask?
Probably Dracula.
Yes! He fights Dracula at the end of level three.
This game, man.
And then the last level. The final level of the game. He's got to find the Turbo Deforester. So he's fighting in a sci-fi set where he's fighting all sorts of various robots Tim the Toolman Taylor has to fight.
Okay.
And, alright, are you ready for the twist when he finds the final tool to complete the set? Are you ready for this?
I'm seated, yes.
So now he's completed the Turbo Deforester. And then the twist is, it was all a ruse by Tim's kids.
What?
Yes, they took the tools from Tim. And then at the end of the game, in the final cutscene, he's like, "Woo, that was a tough one, the Turbo Deforester." And so Tim's son Brad is like, "Gee, great work, Dad. I want to be just like you when I grow up." And then Tim says, "Really, Brad? That's about the nicest thing a dad can hear from his son." And then Brad says, "Yeah, right, Dad. Psych!" And then Al says, Brad must get a sense of humor from you, Tim. And Tim's like, "Wait a minute, look at this note. I don't believe it. Good work, Dad. We knew you could do it." And then Al's like, "Psych! That was great, boys. Tim, you guys are pretty clever. Must take after your old man. Well, the important thing is that the tools are safe and all return safe and sound. So let's launch the new Binford Taylor Turbo Power Tool line." And Al's like, "Gosh, I'm sorry, Tim, but we're out of time. I've been trying to help you introduce the new tools during the show, but someone wouldn't let me." And Tim's like, "Well, we'll see you all next time on Tool Time." So after all that time, it was all a tease. We didn't get to see how the Turbo Deforester worked.
David Crane, how could you?
I like the use of the word "psych." It really sort of puts it in an early to mid 90s time frame. And actually, looking at this game, you know what it reminds me of, and maybe I'm not too far off here. It reminds me a little bit of Sonic the Hedgehog. Not a good version of Sonic the Hedgehog, mind you, but it reminds me a little of Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, every game at that point was trying to be Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yep.
But we're not even getting to the best part of this game, okay? If you bought this game, all right, if you're like a kid of, let's say, 11, 12 years old, let's say you're a big fan of Home Improvement. It was a big show at the time, one of the biggest shows probably of the 90s. So you buy the game, and you want to check out the instruction book of how to play this game. But when you turn into the instruction book, there's a giant sign in the instruction book that says, "Real men don't need instructions where the instructions should be." That's right, folks. The people at Absolute Entertainment figured the kids of America, they're going to figure this game out on their own. They're going to love this game so much that they're not even going to bother to need instructions to play this game.
Hence a callback to our ending of the episode last week when we hinted at this show.
Oh, now it makes sense.
Now it does, yes. Greg, you actually know what would actually have been a better video game than this?
What?
Do you remember the opening sequence that Home Improvement used for a number of years, that video game?
Yes.
I'd play the heck out of that.
You know, here's the thing. You have a Home Improvement video game. At some point in the game, you think there would be like some point where you would turn to Wilson for help?
Oh, yeah. He'd be your lifeline. That would... Oh, now that would have been great.
That would be so entertaining, yeah.
We created a better video game than what was made in like the last 20 seconds. That's brilliant.
How is that even possible? How?
Yeah, Wilson always helped solve Tim's problems whenever he needed help.
Wilson was probably too busy doing Home Depot ads back in the day.
With Homer?
Yeah. Well, there's 9 examples of bad video games that we wanted to talk about. But there's more. We're going to do a second installment of this a little bit later this year. We actually came up with many more video games we can cover, and Greg said, you know what? Why don't we do some now and then do some at a later date? And I said, absolutely. We don't want this going on for 3 hours. So later on this year, not going to tell you when, we're going to revisit this with more video games that just are absolutely abysmal.
Well, that was video games based on TV shows, and I'm just going to say this. I do not think whatsoever that my Triple H impression sounds in any way like Alan Thicke. I don't know what Mike was thinking. I mean, come on, my Triple H does not sound in any way whatsoever like my Alan Thicke impression. I just want to get right out there for the record. But now that we've got that sorted out, we can talk about what's going on over on Place to Be Nation Pop right now. And on the latest episode of Laugh in Theater, in episode 19, host Andy Afferton is joined by Steve Willey from PTBN's Main Event to do a live watch of the 1986 classic Ferris Bueller's Day Off. The guys discuss breaking the fourth wall, Chicago's landmarks, Ed Rooney's vendetta against Ferris, their first cars, taking it too far, how unlikable Ferris really is. Was Cameron really the hero of this story? Yes, I think he was the hero of the story. I mean, he's wearing a Detroit Red Wings Gordie Howe jersey in Chicago. How can he not be the hero of the story if he's brave enough to wear a Gordie Howe Detroit Red Wings jersey? Hey, batter, 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 in-home intercons. Edie McClurg, our favorite here on It Was a Thing on TV. And Charlie Sheen as the voice of reason? Insert Tiger Blood joke here. And also, in a Laugh-In Theater special, in the first special isolation edition of Laugh-In Theater, Andy is joined by the co-hosts of the PTB NXT podcast, Jennifer Spiff, Tim Capel, and Jacob Williams, to do a live watch of The Naked Gun.
The gang discusses evil dictators from the 1980s, Leslie Nielsen's dramatic acting roles, motion sickness, the presence of cake throughout the movie. There's a lot of cake in that movie, let me tell you. O.J. Simpson's filmography, old white guys, talking public restrooms, stuffed beavers, driving lessons, Zippo lighter crowds, sexual organs on ceramic statues, old expired Worcestershire sauce, the parallels to 1989's Batman and Lionfish. So don't forget to boil your roast. Remember not to go 65 down the wrong way on a one-way street and wipe that thing on the side of your face. No, the other side. Well, I don't think you should do any wiping off your face in times like these, but hey, I'm not one to judge. Also, in the meantime, be sure to check out the PTBN Wrestling Feed, which includes a dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Jenny the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, PTB NXT, and so much more. Subscribe today. And while you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position feed as well. This is the new home of Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Driving, Telling Stories, and more. And also check out the North-South Connection, brought to you by JT Rosero and Chad Campbell. It's the home of Wrestling Warzone, No Holds Barred, the Extreme Three-Way Dance, my favorite, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and more. And on the social media pages, the greatest sports logo of 2020 tournaments going on. There'll be four matchups per day, so make sure to like our tournament page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter so you won't miss a single one. And we have kicked off our 2020 stretch project on PTBN, determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have all year to do research, promote matches, and build your list. Conversation rules can be found at www.facebook.com/GWCWmatches or on the Pro Wrestling Only message board. Be sure not to forget to check out PlaceToBeNation.com each and every day. We have new voices and fresh takes bringing you articles and topics in the world of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including Trent's SmackDown on Fox Report, This Week in the WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. And don't forget about veteran columns like Glenn Butler's Wednesday Walk Around the Web. And if you are doing online shopping right now on Amazon.com, and let's be honest, and right now during the pandemic, of course you're doing online shopping at Amazon.com. Who isn't? Be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the Place to Be Nation homepage or use www.placetobenation.com/Amazon. It takes you right to Amazon and helps that PTBN at no cost to you. Okay, it's time for our final topic of the day on It Was a Thing on TV, and we're starting a series of short-lived shows that we have loved by looking at one of our favorite shows from the 1990s. It spent two seasons, one season each on ABC and another season on Fox, from 1994 and 1995, starring John Lovitz as the bald man himself with the catchphrase, "It stinks," that you always hear on our opening to each and every show. It is Jay Sherman. And, of course, that would only mean one thing. It's time to talk about The Critic. Enjoy, everybody.
Episode 38, Submission 165, The Critic. Now I got to pull up the airing history. This is called an edit point. The Critic originally aired on ABC and then Fox from January 26th of 1994 through May 21st of 1995 for 23 episodes.
Is a test of Faye Dunaway's vocal cords. We repeat, this is only a test.
still Hans Zimmer's best work.
Now, Hans Zimmer has done many great, good things since then.
Well, the among Dark, Hans.
Among, yeah. Yeah, it's second next to The Dark Knight.
There you go.
Well, and also got to give props to Alf Clausen, too.
Yes.
He of The Simpsons, he of Alf. Yes. Alf Clausen deserves credit, too. Back in 1990, a little show called The Simpsons put Fox on the map. And it really sort of changed the television landscape. I mean, it's still on TV now, 30 years later. Maybe not as good as it used to be. Maybe not as popular as it used to be, but it's still around. Even though this isn't technically a spinoff of The Simpsons, you sort of got the critic from the same people. And there were a bit of crossovers. We'll get to that in a little bit. The critic, first off, this is like one of my favorite cartoons of all time. This is so underrated. It died a sad death, a quick death. And really, it had so much fodder. All the contemporary movies at the time, plus also they made fun of older movies. It was brilliant. And it wasn't The Simpsons in terms of necessarily, you know, saying eat my shorts and Homer Simpson being an oaf. It was sort of like highbrow comedy or higher brow comedy. There was still...
It was smart comedy.
It was smart comedy, but there were still goofy moments. Specifically, Jay Sherman, who's the main character, he is the critic. He's the title critic in the show. He was a jolly fellow, let's say that. He was portly. And there were gags where his stomach would be sort of like his conscience, you know, saying, okay, hey, listen here, big guy, I need food. You better give me some food right now, darn it. But also, I mean, there were belching jokes. And oh my gosh. I think it happened a couple of times when Jay Sherman belched. It was loud. It was obnoxious. Blah! So the comedy was a smart comedy, like Chico said. It also, you know, there were some roots to The Simpsons. There was juvenile, kind of sort of potty humor like The Simpsons. And it really, now that I think about it, when it was on Fox, it was on between The Simpsons, a good lead-in, and Married with Children. So you have like the two bookends of like horrible, not necessarily horrible fathers, but maybe sort of incompetent fathers or maybe call unorthodox fathers. And then you've got Jay Sherman, who was a separated dad, divorced. But by no means did he live his life the way that Al Bundy or Homer Simpson did.
No.
Well, I mentioned his son. His son was Marty, and Marty was equally portly like his father.
Well, he's a jovial sort. He's portly like his dad. His heart's in the right place, and he is a very confused. I want to say he's a very confused 13-year-old.
12, close enough.
There you go.
And Marty went to a international school, and the international school was kind of unique. And they play on this in a couple of episodes where Marty wants to become student body president and writes a speech that Jay Sherman wrote. Marty Sherman also tried dating Fidel Castro's granddaughter once, and that was quite an interesting episode with him trying to stow away on a plane in a guitar case. And thing is, once he got caught, you know, they're in Cuba. They can't turn around and send him back.
This was before the tensions mellowed
Yeah, this is like 20, at least 20 years before the tensions mellowed. But also, there was a talent show at the school, and Marty did a belly dancing routine, and the piece de resistance of Marty at the talent show was he had an image of the soldiers on Iwo Jima not planting the flag just yet, but he contorted his stomach in such a way that the people on Iwo Jima planted the flag, and you've got Stars and Stripes Forever playing in the background, and the crowd goes wild, and everybody else at the talent show is like not impressed. Marty was just like his father. Also, the same appetite. He was heavy set. He was a big kid. But just like Jay Sherman, Marty liked his food. I remember one episode that Carvel's comes into play because he wanted to get a cookie puss or a cookie opus. And he also mentioned Fudgy the Whale, all Carvel creations. That wasn't the only character in the show. That's Jay's home life to an extent. There's also his work life.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
His work life, he worked for Duke Phillips.
Phillips.
Yes.
Phillips Broadcasting. Phillips Broadcasting, formerly Duke's House of Chicken and Waffles.
Exactly. Duke's Chicken and Waffles, right.
And Duke Phillips was basically the Ted Turner of the station Jay was at.
He was. He exactly was that. He was the Ted Turner of Phillips Broadcasting. And he was, like, rich out of the wazoo. One thing about Duke that shows up in a couple episodes is I don't think they ever say his age. Oh, he's 39 years old. He's 39. What? That's what it says. Duke is supposedly 39 years old, which, honestly, I don't believe it because I always thought he was older than that. Not much older. I was thinking later in his 40s, but he's 39 years old, and his physical abilities, and this is shown in at least one episode, like doing exercises, even exercises with Jay Sherman on his back. He's in good shape, unlike Ted Turner, probably. We don't know that, but we'll just say that. And Jay Sherman's show, Coming Attractions, is on the Phillips Broadcasting. Yeah, Duke Phillips is, he is maybe not just Ted Turner. He's like Ted Turner plus, I would say, maybe Jeff Bezos, even though Jeff Bezos wasn't really around in 1994, 95. Plus also maybe even a little bit of Walt Disney. Maybe?
I would get it. It was sort of like if Ted Turner and Walt Disney sort of kind of merged into a singularity.
The reason I mention that is because Duke Phillips also had an amusement park. He also ran for president once.
We'll get to that later.
We'll get to that later. He also had a disease. He had everything. Jay Sherman's family life goes beyond Marty. You have his father. Oh, my gosh. His father, Franklin Sherman. He might have been the best character on the show.
Oh, yes.
This show would be nothing without him. Franklin Sherman, is it just me or does he look a little bit like Hugh Hefner?
It's not just you.
Yeah. And he certainly didn't act like Hugh Hefner. The best way I could describe him, and I don't want to be mean, is he's like maybe post-stroke in terms of mentality. He's a little off kilter. Let's just say that.
He's eccentric.
He's eccentric, but also weird. Maybe even, I don't want to say delusional, but something that came to mind is, I remember him talking about his first date, and he was in some sort of dreamland, dream sequence with a cow, and he got hit on the head with a hammer, and colored bubbles started coming out of a pipe he was smoking. Again, very weird, very eccentric. but also at the same time very rich.
And also, Franklin was the former governor of New York on the show.
And we found this out during the episode where Duke ran for president.
But as we said, we'll get to that later.
He's also a former ambassador, cabinet member, Rhodes Scholar, and apparently U.S. Secretary of Balloon Doggies.
Oh, yes, that's mentioned in one of the episodes. He was the U.S. Secretary for Balloon Doggies, yes.
To which he says, and I'm doing my piss-poor Franklin Sherman impersonation, I didn't ask to be Secretary of Balloon Doggies. The Balloon Doggies demanded it.
We mentioned some of Franklin Sherman's eccentricities. Some of them include he dressed up as the Energizer Bunny once. So he had the drum with him, and he said it kept on going and going. At a dinner party, he rubbed his rear end on dinner plates. He wore underpants on his head at the dinner table. He drove a monster truck through Guernica, Picasso's Guernica, and destroyed the creation of Adam on the Sistine Chapel with a helicopter. Plus also, and if you saw my Instagram, my personal Instagram at New Year's, he was also Baby 1937. Everybody boogie with Baby 37.
How exactly was he named Baby 37? Did they just pick the best baby around the time?
Well, he was 64 years old. And if this is 1994 minus 64 years old would be 1930. So I'm assuming it's conceivable as a six-year-old he might have worn a New Year's diaper. I don't know. I definitely wouldn't have worn a diaper, I hope, at age six, but that's his problem, not mine.
Well, he's Franklin Sherman. I mean,
that's a Franklin Sherman thing.
That's definitely a Franklin Sherman thing, yes. And there's his wife, Eleanor. And Eleanor, she's the sane one in the pair.
Yes. Eleanor kind of has a voice that's similar to Katharine Hepburn.
Yes, very. Yes, yes, yes. Good call.
Mm-hmm.
And she's Jay's adopted mother. And she has all her wits about her. She really doesn't do anything goofy. Maybe the worst thing she did is she wrote a book, a children's book, about Jay called The Fat Little Pig. And it made a not-too-veiled reference to the fat little pig being Jay, because the face of the pig looked just like Jay, except where a nose is, there was a snout. And so Jay would go in public, and kids would say, "Hey, look, it's the fat little pig. Oink, 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 oink." And obviously that got embarrassing after the first half dozen kids or so. Eleanor is the rational side of that couple. And sometimes you saw Jay's ex-wife, not very often, named Ardith, and she was just an angry, bitter divorcee.
She was angry and bitter before the divorce. In fact, there's a clip in a flashback where she says, "I don't know why I married you." And it was right after they got married.
It's when they had their wedding picture taken. Yes, yes.
Oh.
But it's always something about money, you owe me, alimony. Yeah, she was not the best of wives, to say the least.
Not even close.
But Jay's love life got better because he found Alice in the second season. And Alice and Jay were such an adorable couple. Alice was married to Cyrus Tompkins, a country singer, but she left him and she was suspicious because of Cyrus's album, which was called "I'm Being Unfaithful to My Wife, Alice Tompkins. You Heard Me, Alice Tompkins." Big red flag.
Just a little bit.
She has a certain southern naivete to her, and she has the drawl, and she has the mannerisms and mindset of a good southern female.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, she is played by the divinely amusing Park Overall, who played an identical character on Empty Nest.
Very true. Good point. And Alice also had a little daughter from that marriage, Penny. And Penny was just so adorable.
Oh, God. All I can remember her is, again, voiced by the late, great Russie Taylor, "I must taste blood!"
Well,
Jay,
no.
She's been at your party 15 minutes, and she already wants to taste blood.
Well, but thing is, overall, Penny really enjoyed Jay. She enjoyed Jay as a stepfather, if you will, but also just as a good role model, a good adult in her life. Also, some other characters that we're going to go over just very quickly. You had Jeremy Hawke, who he's an Australian actor. He's Jay's best friend. And he was quite the ladies' man. Let's say that.
Yeah, he was an Australian actor who was. It seemed like he was perennially in between gigs.
Yes, he was always. Yeah, didn't have a steady job. He was always. Trying to find the next gig. But also, again, he was a fan with the ladies. He was a real charmer with the ladies. He had that Australian accent.
And it seems like he can't get the ladies off him, even if he's talked like Bullwinkle.
Yes, and he did that on an episode. "I could even talk like Bullwinkle." And another character that's on this show is Doris, who is voiced by Doris Grau, who, if you don't know who she is, she was Lunch Lady Doris on The Simpsons. Maybe a bit of a stretch. Doris playing Doris on one show and playing Doris on another show. It's almost like Tony Danza. Anytime he plays a role on TV, who does he play? He plays Tony.
Although, sadly, on this show, Doris doesn't grease up groundskeeper Willie.
No. On this show, she plays Jay's makeup artist. And the one thing she is known for is she smokes like a chimney stack. Anytime you see her, there's a cigarette in her mouth. And even one time, Jay Sherman took cigarettes out of her mouth. And what would pop up? Another cigarette. And I think you even heard like a cash register cha-ching. So he took the one cigarette out, cha-ching, new cigarette comes out. Took that one out, cha-ching, new cigarette comes out. Already lit, by the way. But also in one episode, she was almost Jay's biological mother. But DNA tests, without the assistance of Maury Povich, said she is not the mother.
Aww. Aww.
We should also mention that Jay did have a younger sister named Margot. And she was a biological child of Franklin Eleanor. She wasn't adopted. She's 17, and she's a junior at Miss Hathaway's School for Untouched Girls. I'm sorry.
Oh.
And the thing about Margot is she's nothing like her mother. Her mother is this socialite who went to finishing school. Margot can't stand it, and she is, to use a modern term, woke.
And also, she's nothing like her dad.
No. Plus, also, like most teenagers, she's a little bit on the rebellious side, because she did actually date a grunge rock singer in one episode. And she was very close to losing her virginity with him. But she discovered that he was cheating on her, and she broke up with him. In addition, I mentioned Jeremy Hawke earlier. Jeremy and Jay Sherman would meet at a restaurant, and the restaurant was run by a gentleman named Vlada Veramirovich.
Yes.
And I know Greg has stuff to say about Vlada.
Oh, yeah, Vlada was excellent. He was, one of the best characters on the show.
He was, and he had this high-ish voice with a European accent.
Yes.
And he ran the restaurant. And the restaurant was called L'Enriche, which they actually showed in one episode. The name was flashing in neon, and it went from L'Enriche to its name in English, which is called The Wealthy Jackass, or The Rich Jackass. But it on the show, it was called The Wealthy Jackass. And he'd always welcome Jay Sherman by saying, "Ah, Mr. Sherman!" And he'd actually sort of say it like that, with that high voice and that accent. Vlad's son Zoltan also attends the UN school that Marty attends, and he sings in the talent show I mentioned earlier. He sings unintentionally hilarious songs about his homeland. I remember a song like "Hee dee hee dee hee dee poopy," and everybody laughed, ha 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 ha, and he keeps on going, "Hee dee hee dee hee dee poopy, ha ha ha." And it turns out it was like a song about like the mass genocide of his country or something like that. So it really like offended that everybody is laughing at him because of the lyrics of this song. It's about, you know, like the torment that happened in his country.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But actually, I want to go through some of the names, some of the voices. I know that Chico and Greg mentioned some of the voices of some of the characters. I think we need to give credit where credit's due because the voices on this show were absolutely amazing and some of the best voices in the business, to be honest.
Yeah, and we haven't even mentioned who voiced Jay yet.
No, that's where I'm going to start.
Yep, begin with the big one.
Yes, kind of figuratively and literally. John Lovitz.
Yes.
This is like his character. He did this perfectly. You know John Lovitz nowadays from the TV show Funny You Should Ask. But even before then, he was on SNL. And he was on SNL during the great comeback years of the mid to late 80s. And I believe even the early 90s.
Yeah, because he went to 91.
And
the pride of Tarzana, California.
And he was the perfect person for this role. He was great. Christine Cavanaugh played Marty Sherman. So that's sort of like Nancy Cartwright with Bart Simpson. You had a female voice actor voicing a male character. And interestingly enough, who voiced Margot Sherman?
Nancy Cartwright. Cartwright.
There you go. Yeah, Garrett Graham is the voice of Franklin Sherman. Judith Ivey, who we mentioned earlier, was Eleanor Sherman, and Doris Grau, as we said, Lunch Lady Doris, was Doris, the makeup lady. Maurice LaMarche, what can you say about him? He is an amazing voice
actor.
You
cannot say enough about Maurice LaMarche. He's literally the man of 1,000 voices. Well, 1,001. Nobody can tell a blank.
You're absolutely right. He is a legend. He voiced, now these are more or less minor characters. He didn't voice any of the major characters, but Jeremy Hawke, so the Australian actor he voiced. He voiced the principal of the UN school. He voiced Howard Stern. Specifically, I remember there was a parody of The Lion King called The Cockroach King. And was it Simba that was the little lion?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if it's Simba or Pumbaa. I've never seen The Lion King. I got to change it. And the Simba role in The Cockroach King was a cockroach, but it was Howard Stern. You could see the shades, the sunglasses Howard Stern wore, and the long, you know, frizzy hair that he's had for like 30 years now. And he had that Howard Stern voice. And he even said to one of the bugs in the audience, sort of like the opening scene of The Lion King,
"Hey, baby, show me your thorax."
But also, Owen, this...
Orson Welles.
Yes! Orson, he did Orson Welles! Yes!
And
at least on one or two episodes, there were spoofs of the Orson Welles commercials, which you can easily find on YouTube, where he was selling wine, selling peas.
Oh, Rosebud Frozen Peas.
Rosebud Frozen Peas, yes. And I think I'll take a handful for the road. Yes, yes, yes.
This show was basically my introduction to Orson Welles.
It sort of was mine, too. But also, the Orson Welles voice, it wasn't really much of an Orson Welles voice when you actually hear Orson Welles. Because when you hear the voice, it's the exact same voice Maurice LaMarche used when he voiced Brain on Pinky and the Brain and Animaniacs.
Well, the Brain was sort of based off Orson Welles.
Well, it's still the same voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Vlada was voiced by Nick Jameson. And Ardith, the ex-wife, actually had two people voice her. Brenda Vaccaro and Rhea Perlman. And we mentioned Park Overall as Alice and Russi Taylor as Penny. Kath Soucie, another name that's been associated with The Simpsons for years, she did various voices. And same with another Simpsons voice, Tris McNeil. The one voice she's really credited with here is Humphrey the Hippo, which was essentially the critics' version of Barney the Dinosaur.
Yeah.
And they even did the I love you, you love me. They did a song very similar to that. The only real time I remember seeing Humphrey the Hippo is on one episode. The floor of the studio where Coming Attractions was being recorded was sort of flimsy, and Jay was obviously kind of bulky, kind of heavy, and he fell through the floor, fell through about three floors, and ultimately fell through the Humphrey the Hippo show while the kids are holding hands and singing the I Love You song. And so that's like all you see of Humphrey the Hippo. Maybe a little bit more, but not a whole lot more. It wasn't a real recurring character. But enough about the voices and the characters. The show itself.
Yeah.
Now, oh, God. We could. You know what? All the things that you can say about the show and all the things that have been said about the show, we could fill, like, five episodes. The writing was brilliant. The parody and the satire was, you know what, Al Jean and Mike Rice are just masters of the art form, as it were.
Well, I was actually going to take it a different direction. I was going to talk about the broadcasting and production standpoint.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that too.
So the show itself, it started off on ABC as a mid-season replacement on Wednesday nights, following not an entry right now, but maybe somebody might want to add it. Thea,
I'm adding it right now.
Oh, there we go.
Oh yes, Thea, the show that had Brandy and Shelton Benjamin's mama.
So the critic replaced a short-lived sitcom and also future installment called George, which was a sitcom starring George Foreman.
And guess what, guys? He had four kids named George.
Ooh!
And one named Frida. Anyway.
And then, after the first 13 episodes, it was canceled on ABC.
Aww.
But it found Second Life on Fox. And it aired, as I said earlier, 8:30 on Sunday nights, smack between The Simpsons and Married with Children, which I think really it was not a bad time spot. You have The Simpsons, which is, or at least was, the most popular show on Fox at the time, and Married with Children is probably maybe the second most popular show on Fox at that time, and they put the critic right in the middle, and as I said earlier, it's sort of diametrically opposite of those other two shows, because Jay Sherman's the thinking man. And ultimately, it aired 10 episodes, and it got canceled as well, even though the ratings were on the rebound. And actually, believe it or not, there almost was a third life for this show. It almost ended up on UPN.
How is that possible?
UPN says we'd like to pick up the show, but UPN didn't pick it up, even though 9 scripts had already been written for a planned 3rd season. So I think the people at The Critic knew they had something there. It's just ABC didn't want it, and Fox didn't want it, and UPN didn't want it. But one place, and this is where it got a lot of publicity, a lot of views, one place that wanted it was Comedy Central. This aired on Comedy Central in a late-night cartoon block on Sunday nights, and that's where I fell in love with it right there. I mean, I remember seeing it when it was on Fox and ABC, but it was sort of one of those, oh, yeah, it was on the air, then it was off the air a couple of weeks later. But once you start seeing these episodes, like I said, over a 3 or 4 year period on Comedy Central, you sort of fell in love with them.
Yeah.
But then, and this may be in part due to the Comedy Central airings, there was a brief revival of The Critic, kind of, sort of. Very kind of, sort of. In the year 2000, the website Shockwave.com, remember when Shockwave was a thing on the internet?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Shockwave had 10 web-exclusive episodes. And actually, those episodes, and I remember back 20 years ago, I actually saved them on my computer. They're actually available on the DVD box set. So if you can find it, I'm sure it's on Amazon. You can get those webisodes that you couldn't necessarily, well, you could save if you're tech savvy, but yeah, I'm guessing the resolution, especially like nowadays, since monitors are so much better and animation so much better, does it stand the test of time after 20 years? I'm not sure. I'm going to have to revisit that on my DVDs. We mentioned earlier about a relationship, a crossover with The Simpsons. There actually was, it sort of crossed over both ways, albeit not really The Simpsons appearing on The Critic per se. There was an episode where Jay Sherman actually was on The Simpsons.
Yeah, it was A Star is Burns, and Matt Groening, who was, of course, the creator of The Simpsons, had a bone of contention with James L. Brooks, who produces both The Simpsons and The Critic. He saw it as nothing more than advertisement for The Critic, and he had an LMNO for that episode.
Yeah, his name's not even credited in the episode, if I recall.
Yeah, that would be what an LMNO is. Leave my name off.
Oh, I learned something. And as a real stretch, what did Jay Sherman play on this crossover episode with The Simpsons? He played a film critic. A film critic at a film festival.
And this episode was right before the second season premiere.
Yes. And it has probably, in my opinion, one of the most famous bits ever in the history of The Simpsons. Boo Worms. Are you saying boo or boo worms?
Boo!
Boo!
I was saying boo worms.
Oh, and the second funniest bit ever from The Simpsons. Man getting hit by football. Or as Homer Simpson famously called it, football in the groin.
But the football in the groin had a football in the groin.
I'll tell you what, when I saw that when I was 11 years old, I died laughing for, I swear to God, a half hour.
Ooh, dog.
I recorded the episode, and then I would just slow the football getting hit in Hans Bollman's groin, and I'd die every time.
And that's 11-year-old Greg Diener, everybody. Now you know where he gets. But also, The Simpsons sort of appeared on The Critic as well. There was a costume ball once, and Jay and Alice, they went as Homer and Marge Simpson. Well, there also was a brief appearance in an episode called Dial M for Mother, where Jay Sherman was being interviewed by Geraldo, and he was talking over his audience's heads using a lot of college words. So a family that's watching this interview is getting bored and says, let's change the channel. And they change to The Simpsons, and they see Homer, after stepping on a rake, saying, don't! And Bart saying, ay caramba! And what does the father of the family say? Now this I understand. Well, it's sort of self-deprecating. It was a smart comedy.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
It was sort of like polar opposites of The Simpsons, but I think that's part of the reason we love it.
Indeed it is.
How about we look at some episodes and maybe reflect on them?
Yes.
Yep.
We start with the pilot from January 26, 1994, where Jay Sherman gets a second chance at love when a gorgeous movie star named Valerie Fox, voiced by Jennifer Lean, who you may remember from season one of Voyager and all of Men in Black, the series. But it may go all to pieces if Jay doesn't give Valerie a glowing review for her latest movie, the Basic Instinct-inspired erotic thriller, Kiss of Death. Here's the thing. Kiss of Death. Valerie Fox in Kiss of Death. She bad.
Well, there's a lot of comparisons here to Sharon Stone in terms of looks, in terms of actions. Valerie Fox has long, flowing blonde hair, starlit looks. See, even at one point when talking with Jay Sherman, does the old Sharon Stone leg cross.
Oh, my.
You know what I'm talking about. Right?
Yeah.
Woo! So, in the end, Valerie and Jay sort of have a relationship, but it gets broken off because Jay gave Valerie a bad review in the movie Kiss of Death.
Yeah. And here's the thing about Valerie. You know how she's trying to convince everybody that she's not dating Jay just to get a good review. And for a while it seems to work. But the truth came out when Jay walked through the door and Valerie slaps him, only to say, you're short, you're fat, and even for a critic, you're ugly.
And then the best part of the episode is she's going to the airport and Jay's like, now I know people think that I'm a cynic, but I'm not, because I know you're coming back to me now. 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 Now.
And I think you have to envision that every like image when he says now gets further and further away.
Yeah.
So she might be nearby on the first now, but then you pull back a little bit on the second one. The third one, she's on the plane. The fourth one, the plane's leaving. Yeah.
And the fifth one's all that's left is that guy with that like, that thing that cleans all the garbage.
Mm-hmm. Garbage can?
No, that you know, those that thing at the airports where you sweep the garbage.
Yeah.
Dustpan?
Something like that.
Okay. But also, I just want to share the number of viewers this had. If it received this many viewers nowadays, it would be on for 20 years.
Oh, yes.
15.3 million people saw the pilot.
Tells you how much television has changed over 26 years.
Yeah.
And even 15.5 million people back in 1994 was a ton.
This was, like, this was an incredible, incredible show back in the day.
Or at least incredible numbers to begin with. They fell off a little bit. We'll get to that as we move on. The second episode, in terms of production, it actually looks like it aired fourth, is entitled Miserable. And this episode provided maybe the most memorable moment in the critics' history. Miserable was based on the movie Misery. If you've ever seen the movie Misery, you have James Caan playing an author, and you have Kathy Bates playing essentially an obsessed fan.
Paul is caught in a blizzard. His car goes off the road. A nurse named Annie Wilkes finds Paul and brings her to his her remote home. And then he regains consciousness and finds himself bedridden with broken legs and a dislocated shoulder. Annie claims to be his number one fan and talks a lot about him and his novels.
And that is essentially the basis of this episode. Except just, you know, change some names. Change the location to an apartment in New York City. Instead of being tied by ropes, he's being tied down with film. He gets saved because of a display for when he had a book. And this display, it had an automated moving arm, and it would say what phrase repeatedly? Say it with me, guys.
Buy my book.
And ultimately, once he's rescued, this gets so annoying that the police actually shoot it. Probably the best moment ever. And yeah. I feel almost compelled to add right now, talking about books and talking about previous episodes, buy Adam's book.
A little bit of trivia about this episode. It was actually supposed to air in production order, but it was put off for a couple of weeks because ABC censors barred it from being shown due to unsuitable content.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What was unsuitable about that episode?
Yeah, why would we so unsuitable for the people at ABC to say, nope, we're not airing this?
Probably being kidnapped and tied to the bed. I don't know. I don't know what was going through.
I saw things on the original run of Twin Peaks that were more disturbing than that.
But it did ultimately air. It aired on the February 16th. Thank you, Brain.
And I want to add who wrote this episode. Steve Levitan, who you might better know from some other shows of his, including a little something called Arrested Development, another little something called Modern Family, and another thing, future installment, L.A. to Vegas.
But also, future installment, Greg the Bunny.
Very soon, future installment, Greg the Bunny. There you go.
And another future installment. Stacked.
Yes. So yeah, he wrote this episode before really hitting the big time. Episode 3, which is actually the second aired episode, Marty's First Date. Marty invites his father, Jay, to career day at school, where Marty falls for a Cuban girl named Carmen, who is later revealed to be the granddaughter of Fidel Castro. We talked about this earlier, about Marty stowing away in the plane in a guitar case, and then the guitar case opens up, and next thing you know, there's 5-6 security agents around him with guns drawn, and he explains, oh, I just wanted to see Carmen and go down to her homeland, Cuba, which obviously in 1994 was not a thing. And, yeah, lo and behold, the grandfather is Fidel Castro. He's actually treated like a nice grandfatherly human being. He's not treated like the dictator he was. My takeaway is there was a parade going on. I forget what the parade was for. And it was commentated by what could best be described as a Willard Scott type of figure or character. And I'm guessing somebody else from around that time, maybe like a Jane Pauley type. But I remember the Willard Scott one. And the parade was being sponsored by toilet paper. Now in rough and extra rough.
Okay. Going to episode 3, Dial M for Mother.
Third aired episode, but fourth in production.
There
terms.
You go. When test audiences brand Jay Sherman worse than Hitler, Duke sets
that's
up a
Borsch.
Oh yeah. Duke sets up a TV special where Geraldo Rivera interviews Jay with his adoptive mother Eleanor, which falls apart when Jay yells at Eleanor.
Yeah, Eleanor reveals some stuff about Jay, which Jay didn't take too kindly towards. And I believe it had to do something with him as a baby and something he said when he had, like, diaper rash or something like that. And he just said, "Mom, stop it. This interview's over. I don't want to talk to you anymore." And so, you know, that was part of the episode, and the rest of it was sort of trying to rectify the relationship.
Yeah. And the thing of it is, Eleanor turns out that she was taken to hospital because of what I'm assuming is broken heart syndrome.
Aww. Episode 5, both in terms of production and order of airing, is A Little Devil Do You. Eleanor forces Margot to get prepared for and attend a debutante ball, despite Margot's protests over how sexist and elitist it is. Meanwhile, Jay gets into a ratings war with children's show host Humphrey the Hippo.
Yes!
Yeah. Then it turns into something else entirely.
Also, I'd just like to point out that Humphrey the Hippo, which is linked here in Wikipedia, what does it take you to if you click through it? It takes you to Barney and Friends.
Bravo!
Very nice, Wikipedia. Very nice.
Well done. Episode 6, Eyes on the Prize. Jay rethinks his career when his 1,000th episode bash is a dud. He seeks advice from image consultant Adolf Hitmaker, which was voiced by Phil Hartman, but his advice and all other attempts at recreating his TV image prove unsuccessful.
This is the episode where he was actually looking for another Pulitzer. Now I remember this episode. If the movie stinks, just don't go.
Yes, that's the line that like everybody says when he gets his Pulitzer. If the movie stinks, just don't go. If the movie stinks, just don't go. And
here comes
father,
Franklin.
Yes, what did Franklin say? Yes.
If the movie stinks, do-si-do.
Do-si-do, yes!
but there is some truth in what he said, basically. It's like, if it's based on a TV show, don't go. If it's a sequel, give it a rest. If it's a remake of the classic, rent the classic.
He's not wrong.
But also, this episode had one of my favorite movie parodies, and that was Arthur 3, Revenge of the Liver.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, where Arthur gets diagnosis that he has less than a year to live, but he informs the doctor.
Acute hepatitis. And you have a cute little butt.
But he informs the doctor to don't look now, but someone's stolen all your popsicles. Which is exactly the same thing I've thought to myself whenever I visited the doctor. Someone has stolen all the popsicles.
So this episode also features Jay Sherman's student film titled L'Artiste est mort, which means the artist is dead in French. They like their French phrases here. And the one big takeaway, now first off, it's so bizarre, but at the end you see Jay Sherman's feet dangling like he hung himself, unfortunately. But then someone comes in the scene and says, "Oh no, my Prometheus." And you can hear him whisper, "That's Prometheus." And then you see Finn pop up, F-I-N, Finn, end of the movie. And Everybody is sitting there. Jeremy's watching this, Marty's watching this, and they've all got like this look of disbelief as the film ends and you hear the film reel thwap, 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 thwap as it goes, is going around. No, it's Prometheus.
Oh, no, Prometheus.
Oh, no, Prometheus. That's Prometheus.
Yes.
Episode 7, Every Doris Has Her Day. Oh, Doris Day, sorry, joke there, a little play on words. Jay befriends his makeup lady, Doris, after they attend a musical adaptation of The Hunchback of Notre Dame and thinks she may be the mother who gave him up for adoption years ago. We talked about that earlier, that, as Maury would say, she is not the mother.
But I do like this episode because I thought it had a lot of heart in it, had a lot of heart, had a lot of soul, and had one of the greatest ending lines I've ever heard in a musical. Brought to you by Toyota, the hatchback fit for a hunchback.
That's why we said this is like an intelligent TV show. This may have been almost too smart for their audience, but it was darn good. Episode 8, Marathon Mensch. Jay's masculinity is called into question after Doris rescues Jay from a studio fire, so Jay trains for the New York Marathon. And he actually does take part in the marathon. It takes him like forever to finish the marathon, but he gets it done. And I think he did it for Marty, which makes sense because he is Marty's role model. He is Marty's everything, and vice versa.
Yeah.
But also, I remember in this episode, there was a parody of the Bad News Bears starring Tony Curtis called Bad News Mets. And what I remember is it included a joke about when Vince Coleman threw a firecracker at Dodgers Stadium. That would have been very timely at the time.
He wouldn't have been with the Mets at the time, but it was definitely very timely because by that point, I think Vince Coleman would have been probably with the Royals, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But still, the firecracker incident, I believe, was about 1990?
No, it was 93.
93, okay.
90 would have been his last year with the Cardinals.
Ah, okay. I stand corrected. All right. Episode 9, L.A.J. Jay moves to Los Angeles when studio executive Gary Grossman, who was voiced by Billy Crystal, offers the critic a chance to write the second sequel to the Ghost Chasers franchise. And by the way, in Wikipedia, Ghost Chasers links directly to Ghostbusters. Shocker, I know.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about, and one of those, and again, it had one of those memorable, but at the same time, not scenes. I showed it to this one guy. He said, it had heart. I showed it to Jazzman Joe, it's got soul. And I showed it to Hasidic Harry, it could have been worse.
Ultimately, Jay believed he actually was going to sell this script, and it turned out that it ended up in the circular file, and Jay was a little upset and went back to New York. Aww.
Yeah.
Episode 10, Dr. J. Duke is diagnosed with a rare disease, and Jay is determined to find a cure. And we mentioned this earlier. We said Duke was diagnosed with Duke Phillips disease.
Wow. He got his own disease.
So about that episode, Chuka, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, it starts at the Cannes Film Festival, where Duke was displaying Phillips vision, which replaces downer endings with happier endings. And when he's gone to defend this new quote-unquote innovation, clutches his chest, falls to the ground, and is given 4 years to live. Jay works on a sort of a remedy to this symptom, to this syndrome. He's mixing chemicals and Snapple, testing it out on a hamster, and all of a sudden he sneezes into it, and that proves to be, boom, that's the X Factor. So Duke takes the serum and is instantly cured. So Jay asks for one thing in return for Phillips's oil, you have to get rid of Philip's vision. And it turns out that this serum has also been used on a member of the Ku Klux Klan, a whale clubber, a couple of neo-Nazis, and a trio of prisoners.
Oh.
And once again, written by one of the greats of the medium, John Vitti.
Episode 11, A Day at the Races and a Night at the Opera. After Marty bombs out during his elementary school field day, Jay buys his son a guitar and encourages him to take lessons. Meanwhile, after Them magazine christens Jay the wittiest man in the world, Duke offers to pay $100 to every viewer who does not find Jay funny.
Oh, boy.
This is the episode, if I recall, where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar guest stars in a cameo where he has Jay as little knothead.
Yes, you're exactly right about that.
That he calls him Dr. Knothead after Jay complains. This is demeaning. I have a PhD in film. Okay, Dr. Knothead.
So, regarding the subplot of this episode, where Duke was going to pay $100 to people who don't laugh at Jay's show, all the defendants in a court case regarding this, they were actually at the Meadowlands Sports Arena in Secaucus, New Jersey, and they sang a version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Except it's not Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Here's what it is.
We're all suing Jay Sherman. We want damages too. We're going to take him for every nickel.
You're the reason that we're in this pickle.
Shut up.
And then episode 12, Uneasy Rider.
Ah, I remember this one. He quits this show to become a truck driver after he's asked to promote Savvy Indian Chewing Tobacco. But Duke does find somebody to promote it. Not it's Rex Reed, who replaces the Shermometer with the Rexel Thermometer.
Yuck, yuck, yuck.
Hey, yummy. Yummy, yum, yum.
And Jay Sherman, when he became a long-distance trucker, what was his CB handle?
Well, first it was Lard Butt.
Lard Butt, yes!
Then it became Hard Butt. And the ultimate irony is, what was he hauling across the country? Savvy Indian Chewing Tobacco.
Another great episode.
Yep.
And then the last episode from the ABC run, A Pig Boy and His Dog. Eleanor writes a children's book called The Fat Little Pig, and we mentioned this earlier, featuring a character based on Jay. Meanwhile, Jay adopts a Great Dane puppy who grows up too fast and becomes a nuisance. Because Great Danes aren't dainty little dogs. They're not little Pomeranians or anything like that. But yeah, this is the one where all of the children would call Jay the fat little pig and go oink, oink, oink. Yeah, and another reason for Jay to be upset with his mother. Meanwhile, she's a writing superstar because she wrote this hit book.
This also has one of my favorite movie parodies where they have Barney the Dinosaur, the movie, with Marlon Brando as Barney the Dinosaur. With Marlon Brando inside the Barney the Dinosaur costume. Because I guess they couldn't afford Caitlin Dever's dad to do the voice.
And meanwhile, Margo and Eleanor are talking about her future plans to attend Eleanor's alma mater, L'Université Française de Hackensack.
Oh, more French. This should have been required watching for French classes back in the day with all the French names in this show.
And another thing that this episode did was rely on the fact that what comes out after this episode? Home Improvement. Two of Franklin's jokes, he goes out back, and asks for advice from a person he thinks is Wilson, but is
I know what's coming.
Is Scarecrow, and the first time he ends up talking to a frog, says, "Ribbit, ribbit, ribbit." Goes to Eleanor and says, "You should rivet. Rivet, rivet, rivet."
And you see her with a construction hat on, a hard hat, riveting, yes. But then the second time, Chico, do it!
Well, it looks like, my wife is happy.
Ooh.
My wife, Eleanor.
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 Ooh. And this continues ad nauseum.
Yep.
Again, so many great moments from this show.
And it ends just perfectly with somebody is writing Tiny, and then Jay is being drugged by a pack of little pigs, saying goodnight, and a special goodnight to everybody tuning in for Home Improvement. Huh?
And then it moved to Fox in 1995. The first episode that aired on Fox was Sherman, Woman and Child, and this is where we meet Alice. Jay worries he may be fired due to Coming Attractions' low ratings and Duke suddenly being nice to him. He then befriends a single mother from the South named Alice and develops feelings for her. However, Alice's adulterous country-singing husband, Cyrus, voiced by Sam McMurray, has returned and wants her back. And guess who she goes to in the end? She stays with Jay.
Aw. Have one of the greatest moments at the end. Alice, you make every home a palace. Even Brooklyn would be Dallas if you would be with me, or something like that. And then here comes Jay with an accordion. Cyrus, he's just a virus. He wants to tie you down while you're still young. Your potential is what's essential. You could be the next Connie Chung. Oh, God.
There's a timely reference.
Yeah, because this was around the time where she was co-hosting the CBS Evening News with Dan Raver.
Uh-huh.
Well, but also it's around the time that her and Maury Povich came forward with their issues regarding having children.
Yeah.
And then episode 2 in the Fox run, Sherman of Arabia, at Marty's slumber party, Jay tells the story of how he ended up in Iraq during the Gulf War in the early 1990s.
Oh, yes. And one of my favorite parts in the episode is he's at the Iraqi Film Festival watching an Iraqi adaptation of Green Acres called Brown Acres.
What's next, my mother, the camel?
And he was eventually thrown in jail where he escaped and led a troop of men across the desert. Sort of sounds a little bit like Lawrence of Arabia, if you ask me.
That's exactly what Jay said.
And also, all the critics rallied around Jay with a special tribute song called Critic Aid.
Yes, and they actually did have Rex Reed, and they had
Gene Shalit.
They had Gene Shalit, and they had Siskel and Ebert. That's some star power right there. You got like the four best film critics in America at that time, and they're all contributing to this episode.
Somewhere out a rocky way, beneath the sands, is our friend Jay. He fought off bombs and bayonets. To him we raise our raisinets.
But the hour 75 they raised would come too little, too late.
Next up, episode 3 in the Fox run is A Song for Margot. This is where Margot dates the grunge rocker we mentioned earlier, Johnny Rath, from the band Nuns in a Blender. And the subplot of this episode is Alice trying to find a good preschool for Penny, her daughter.
And guess who is all but willing to oblige?
Franklin.
Yep.
And you know that can't go over too well.
Actually, no. Alice goes to Rainbow's End, which was just ideal. But the headmaster refuses to admit Penny. Alice explains the situation to Jay, who turns to Duke for help. And then Duke confronts the headmaster, and he jokingly challenges Duke to build his own bigger and better preschool, which he does. The Duke Phillips Preschool, built on a dare.
Next episode is From Chunk to Hunk. Jay and Marty go to a weight loss camp where Marty dramatically loses weight and becomes one of the popular kids in school. At the same time, Jay fears for his life when a pretty boy action star threatens to kill him. The sad thing about this episode is, yes, Marty lost all this weight, but he wasn't happy inside. And he ended up getting it all back. Because yeah. He wanted to be himself. He didn't like being thin, even though he was more popular with the students. But he became his old chubby self, if you will.
And this also has one of my favorite parodies, which is a parody of Speed called Speed Reading. Dennis Hopper has to make Keanu Reeves read a book. If he reads on under 50 words a minute or less, the book explodes. And the joke is, Keanu Reeves is reading very, very slowly.
And the book is One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish.
Oh, and the pretty boy action star, boy, I wonder who they're talking about here, is Belgian actor Jean-Paul Le Pope. I have no idea who they might be referencing there.
Here's the thing. His name references Jean-Claude Van Damme. His design references Steven Seagal.
He looks exactly like Steven Seagal with the ponytail. Absolutely. Before Steven Seagal got all lumpy. But yeah, he looks just like him.
Yeah, before Steven Seagal looked like the dead ringer for Anthony Ainley as the master.
And the word is not lumpy, it's fluffy.
Fluffy, lumpy. Interesting that was on. We're talking about this on an episode called From Chunk to Hunk. Steven Seagal sort of did the opposite. He went from hunk to chunk.
Okay, next episode. That would be.
I'm not wrong, though.
No, you're not.
No.
Episode 18, Lady Hawk. We actually get to meet Jeremy Hawk's sister.
Ah, the lovely Olivia Newton Hawk.
Yes. And after Jay takes Olivia on a tour of the city, she falls in love with him and the two start dating. And what do you think happens? It strains the relationship between Jay and Alice, who realizes that she's also in love with Jay. So two women, one film critic, what's a man going to do? And next episode is Frankie and Ellie Get Lost. Franklin and Eleanor are presumed dead after their plane crashes on the island, and Jay uses the money left to him in the will to make New York City a better place. There's so much good stuff going on here. First, when Franklin and Eleanor go on this trip, on this vacation, Franklin goes to the cockpit, and who's piloting the plane?
Monkeys.
But a penguin. No, penguin.
Oh, sorry.
Penguins can't fly.
Yeah. So the joke going into the commercial break is, penguins can't fly. Penguins can't fly. And you see the plane then spiral down and crash. But also, Jay uses the money left to him to make New York City a better place. That include cleaning up the city. And not just cleaning up in terms of, like, crime, but also in terms of, like, pollution, dirt, stuff like that. And another moment that's ingrained in my brain forever, Jay takes a hose and starts cleaning off buildings by spraying water at it. And he gets to the library and he starts he starts shooting water from the hose at the library, and unfortunately, a letter of the signage for the library falls off. The letter that fell off is the letter L. It was from the sign that says New York Public Library. Get rid of the L in public, and you have New York Pubic Library. And everybody starts running into the library because it's the New York Pubic Library, and they're disappointed when they find out it's the same old books that were in the regular library.
Oh, that's horrible.
It's horrible, but it's funny.
And while I was thinking about monkeys in this episode, it turns out the monkey butler, which was a surrogate for Shackelford. Shackelford, by the way, being their regular butler.
Yes, I remember that. Episode 20, Siskel and Ebert and Jay and Alice. And this, oh my gosh, this I think has one of the best endings. I love this. So after Jay attends the Academy Awards, Siskel and Ebert, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, break up and each rope Jay to be their new partner. So this episode, the ending is absolutely great. So Jay was able to lure Siskel and Ebert on the top of a roof. And in this scene, the lights on another building light up and form a heart, to which Siskel and Ebert comment and say, well, this is just a ripoff of Sleepless in Seattle. And one of them also says, and itself, Sleepless in Seattle was a ripoff of An Affair to Remember. And then he says, what, Greg?
Which wasn't that good of a movie to start with.
Said like film critics.
Yeah. And I also remember this was probably like one of the best episodes of The Critic. I remember when Gene Siskel passed away in 1999 on Siskel and Ebert, when they did the tribute to Gene Siskel, Roger played one of the clips from that episode on the show.
I didn't know that. That's great.
I didn't know that either.
Episode 21, All the Duke's Men. Duke runs for president and hires Jay to be his campaign manager.
Oh, but this is why we one of my favorites, because you have at the start we mentioned Morty was running for United Nations class president, and who happens to be one of the candidates in the debate against him?
Zoltan Veremirovich.
Not only that, but you also have for some reason in the debate Michael Dukakis,
because he figured. I would start with an election I could win.
Yeah.
Boo! You suck!
And it's funny because you know who portrayed Michael Dukakis on SNL?
John Lovitz.
Yup.
It's all come full circle.
Mm-hmm. And Marty and both of the campaigns have sort of disastrous ends, starting with Marty, who ends up completing only half of the class's float in the parade. There's a parade. It turns the eighth grade float was it was supposed to be a horse, right?
Yes, it turns out a horse.
It was supposed to be a horse. Turns out to be the back end of the horse.
And then it becomes a flaming horse's pursuit. And then it destroys the Winter Garden Theater playing Cats. And Jay has one of the most iconic lines, and nothing of value was lost. So, also in the episode, as we mentioned, Duke begins his run for the presidential nomination. He was kind of like the prototypical Mike Bloomberg of 1996, thinking that he could buy the nomination. Because, you know, this isn't timely at all, isn't it?
Just a bit, you know.
Yeah. But one of my favorite parts in the episode is where he has this Hall of Presidents type thing with, like, caricatures of, like, Lincoln and Kennedy talking about, ask Watt what you can do for your country, but what you can do for Duke Phillips.
He can fool half the people all the time, but she can't fool old Duke. Ultimately, Duke ends up hiring June Lockhart to be his wife.
Yes. And not only that, one of the promises also was Duke would try to bring back everyone who was lost in space, even Dr. Smith.
Yeah.
So then, later in the episode, Duke decides he needs a running mate, and who better to get as his running mate than Jay's dad, Franklin.
Former governor of New York, Franklin Sherman.
Yes, and as... And... Hold up. So, Franklin, when he reveals himself to Jay that he's going to be Duke's running mate, he says, I'm going to be vice president. And I'm going to be honest with the American people. I'm not going to wear this toupee anymore. And he rips off his hair. And then Jay says, Dad, you don't wear a toupee. Franklin says, I will from now on.
And ultimately, Duke decides, once Jay quits his campaign, to just be honest. Three guesses how that ends up.
No, not good.
Not good at all.
Probably the same as the Mike Bloomberg campaign.
Well, it didn't end with Lassie biting Duke Phillips, or Lassie biting Mike Bloomberg in the you-know-where, you know?
But darn it, it should have.
Okay. Episode 9 of Season 2, Dukerella. Alice's upstaging sister arrives in search of a rich husband and quickly turns her attentions to Jay.
Why?
Every woman wants Jay in this show. You had it in the pilot. You have it now. You had it at the start of the second season with Alice. Everybody wants a film critic.
Yeah,
apparently.
But ultimately, she falls in love with Duke while she's at a disguise party. So Duke doesn't know who this lady is, and he gets desperate trying to look for her.
Yeah, and basically, it turns into Cinderella. There's a lost slipper, and Duke must find who had the slipper and goes to every female to see if their foot fits in the slipper.
Yeah.
And one little twist, the slipper didn't fit Miranda. The slipper fit Doris.
Oh, boy. But, hey, Miranda has a job at Mattress in an Hour. Everybody suggests Duke call Mattress in an Hour. And magic ultimately happens.
Duke got a mattress in an hour?
Duke got a mattress in an hour.
Man, those are some good times.
And the final broadcast episode, fittingly enough, I can't believe it's a clip show.
And it's pretty much what you just said. It was a clip show. But with one little twist. During the clip show, which happened to be the 10th anniversary show of Coming Attractions at Carnegie Hall, the show's held hostage by terrorists. Fortunately, in the end, everybody is rescued, and you won't believe who rescues everybody.
Who rescues everybody?
Milton Berle.
Oh, that's great. You have Uncle Milty coming in to save the day.
His legendary genitalia went into the bomb and confused the wires so much.
Oh.
Too bad he couldn't save this show.
One fact I want to mention about this episode, it actually was supposed to air originally a month earlier, but considering that there was kind of, if you think about the time frame, May of 1995, and you think of a certain event that happened the previous month,
yeah.
You can see why they moved it.
Yeah.
And then there are 10 webisodes. We're not going to go through the webisodes. As I said, they are on the DVD set, which you can find. And actually, the DVD set was so popular, it's been through 5 printings now.
Wow.
Or at least 5 printings. So that tells me people love this show, just like the three of us.
Yep.
And to end the episode, we're going to talk about the end of each episode. The end of each episode was great. You had Jay sitting in a theater, in a movie theater, watching the credits on the screen, and then you'd have an usher saying, "It's time to leave, Mr. Sherman," or the film's over. And Jay always had, they used like 5 or 6 different lines. "Yeah, I'm stuck in the seat," something like that. Absolutely great way to end the show.
Yeah, it was. Is the snack bar still open?
Yes. And with that, we're going to put this show to rest.
Yep, The Critic was perhaps one of the most brilliantly written, brilliantly produced, brilliantly animated shows on television. But because it was perhaps maybe too smart for its time, it was just a thing on TV.
But it was a beloved thing on TV.
It was a beloved thing on TV.
Indeed. So as always, remember you can find back episodes, social media links, everything you'd like to know about the show at itwasthethingontv.com. Please be sure to like and subscribe, rate and review, tell us how we're doing.
And don't forget to share, because sharing is caring.
Yep.
That's what the kids say.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And later on this week, we're going to come back with another episode of another beloved show that we really, really enjoy. We're definitely not being snarky on these episodes. These are episodes that we absolutely love. So that'll be happening later on this week. Until then, thank you for listening. We'll talk to you soon.
Voices are impersonated. No celebrities were harmed in the filming of this episode.
Excuse me, the show's over.
Get away, Pipsqueak.
That's why I love her.